Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
It's weird. You would think during COVID that you would have a couple of drinks, and I have it, man, because I was, you know, trying to get back. You know, I went back to school, and I just been, you know, trying to focus on me, because I know I didn't want that COVID-19, meaning those 19 pounds, to jump on me like a lot of my friends. I said maybe 12 jumped on me, but not 19. So I got less work to do now that we can get back into the gym. So
on how to take care of yourself now that our listening area is slowly emerging from the pandemic. We picked five different topics based on what we've been hearing from you and seeing around the internet. On Monday, we'll tackle sunscreen now that vaccinated people are going maskless outdoors just in time for summer when your nose hasn't seen a UV ray for more than a year. That'll be on Monday. But now we'll turn to exercise, how to get back into it after the pandemic, including for the many of you who have had COVID and are managing your respiratory systems, or just those of you who haven't had COVID and been more sedate. Joining me now is Heather Moore, a physical therapist and member of the U.S. Olympic Committee sports medicine team. Dr. Moore, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with your patients who have recovered from COVID. What sort of post-COVID symptoms do you find they are experiencing when it comes to working out?
I think the most interesting thing we're finding is it doesn't matter whether you had symptoms during COVID or not. Everyone's experiencing a lot of these same post-COVID symptoms. And one of them is respiratory. People are finding it very hard to get back to working out. Going up the stairs can be a challenge. Breathing is an issue. We're also seeing a lot of joint pain, unexplained joint pain, back pain, neck pain, knee pain. And like I said, again, this is not for somebody who had severe symptoms. We're seeing this with people who had no symptoms whatsoever, but went to go back to their normal lives and now are really having issues with breathing and things.
Explain the knee pain and other joint pain, because we think of COVID as more of a respiratory disease.
Correct. And that's one of the things that we're starting to study and starting to find out, because everyone's studying the lungs. But what we're seeing is people have just come in never having had a knee pain issue before or a back pain issue before. And they're about a month out of COVID and they go to resume some normalcy to their lives, walking, what have you. And they're getting this sharp pain, and the sharp pain becomes a dull pain when they're not moving, and then gets sharper as they start to move. And there's nothing showing up on x-ray or MRI. There's nothing really wrong with the muscles. It's just more of this joint pain that we're starting to see that is this universal. It gets really bad with activity. And then when I rest it, it's still there, but it's duller. And this is kind of a universal post-COVID symptom that we're seeing.
If someone is having symptoms post-COVID, let's say some kind of long haul, and I know it expresses differently in different people, but is one type of exercise safer or more restorative than another, like strength training versus cardio or anything like that?
So when you're resuming any type of workout, you want to just start off at a nice, easy walk, whether it's riding a bike. I don't recommend doing high-intensity interval workouts when you're just getting back, but find the activity you like to do. It could be yoga. It can be a gentle strength training, but definitely take it back a notch and slow down and ease back into it. Otherwise, you're really risking serious complications, like going to the hospital or tearing something. You want to make sure that whatever you choose, it's just a nice, easy, more for endurance rather than really hitting it hard and doing a lot of strength.
What about the people who have had respiratory problems from COVID, long haul, or if they just recently had COVID and they're recovering from their initial bout? How do you get back into cardiovascular, you know, cardio exercise if you've had a respiratory problem?
So this is something that you really want to have monitored by a medical professional, because we are seeing actual damage to the lungs, and that can be very detrimental to you if you push it too much. But if you are wanting to start something on your own, gentle walking, I usually say just start off with about 10 minutes and increase that weekly if you can. But don't listen to your body. So many people ignore their body. So many people don't listen to it when it hurts or it's telling you to stop. And this is a time where you have to listen to it. If it's telling you you're doing too much, you're doing too much. But I always say 10 minutes of walking, 15 minutes of walking, start there and slowly build up. And then maybe you do like run walk intervals if you are inclined to run. Otherwise, you just stick with a healthy walk. And that's about 30 minutes a day at a good pace, not a stroll, but a good pace. But when you're just getting back into it and you have had respiratory symptoms, you want to just start off at that stroll. Just get outside and make sure you're getting those lungs working again.
In Indianapolis, a medical device company is taking an innovative approach to its manufacturing. It's building a grocery store in the same neighborhood as its new manufacturing plant. Side Effects Public Media's Farah Yousri reports that the goal is to help attract and retain workers living in a food desert.
What do fresh vegetables and medical devices have in common? It's this area on the northeast side of Indianapolis where Cook Medical will make needles, catheters, and a range of other medical devices used at hospitals all over the world. But this construction is for something different.
It was never part of our business plan to have a grocery store.
That's Pete Youngman, president of Cook Medical, a multi-billion dollar family-owned manufacturer based in Bloomington. His company is locating one of its manufacturing sites to Arlington Woods, an underserved Indianapolis area. It's planning to hire as many as 100 local workers.
And one of the things that we heard from so many people was that food access was a problem. They had 5 grocery stores leave in the last 5 years. And so you have 100,000 people with no access to groceries.
So Cook Medical decided to spend nearly $2.5 million to build a 15,000 square foot grocery store. It will serve the community and maybe help retain employees. Derek Coleman has been living in this predominantly African-American neighborhood for more than 34 years.
When you need a gallon of milk, you got to travel 5 miles to go. But the new marketplace is coming. We're only about maybe 5 minutes from there. So it's really going to enhance the area. And we're really excited about it. That store is going to be a part of our community.
And here's where the story takes another twist. Cook Medical will not run this store for long. Instead, it will turn it over to Michael McFarland and Marcus Williams, two young local entrepreneurs. The two men are in their early 30s and are childhood friends who live in this neighborhood. They've seen the challenge that food access poses, especially to elderly residents like McFarland's grandmother.
She's not able to get to a place that has adequate food supply. She's relying on family members right now. She's an independent lady and, you know, sometimes she might want to go to the grocery store, but it's 10, 15 miles away.
A few years ago, Williams and McFarland started a small convenience store at a nearby strip mall. After grocery stores closed here one by one, it became a lifeline for many residents. Soon they will shut it down and start managing the new grocery store when it opens next year through a rent-to-own model.
So our projected sales, we should be able to pay it off in about 2 to 4 years. So that's not bad to own your own grocery store.
Harvard Business School professor Kash Rangan says if it's done right, this can be a win-win for everyone.
The positive aspect of this is you're solving a real problem.
He sees the project as a unique partnership between a business and the community. By responding to the community's specific needs, even if they don't align with the company's core business, companies can drive change and help solve real social and economic problems.
This is the brilliant model where they're really being driven by community. So they will take the next step. It's a new model. It's a unique model. But they have to go the extra mile for it to be successful.
Rangan says ongoing support from the company will be crucial if building a grocery store in a food desert will be something more than a corporate vanity project. Marcus Williams and Michael McFarland say they have a personal vested interest in both the community and the store and are bent on its success. For NPR News, I'm Farah Yousri.
Yes, sir. Gus, had you noticed that the term hate crime is also being used with the, I think, the Palestinian and Israeli, I guess they say, conflict, or the different groups, I guess, clashing with one another. I don't know if clashing or being in conflict with one another, like in New York in certain places, that the term hate crime was used, and they showed a white man with, I guess, injuries, and they kept using that term hate crime.
The ceasefire in Gaza is holding for now. But while the confrontation between Israel and the Palestinian group Hamas was taking place, there were growing reports of anti-Semitic attacks and slurs in several American cities. William Brangham focuses on the disturbing questions this raises once again about intolerance and hate in America.
Judy, the Anti-Defamation League tracked reports of online comments, verbal confrontations, and physical assaults in the U.S. during that 11 days of bombing in Gaza and in Israel, finding, quote, a drastic surge in anti-Semitic language and attacks. That included an attack on a 29-year-old man in New York who was punched, kicked, and pepper sprayed in Times Square. In Los Angeles, five people suffered minor injuries after they were attacked by people waving Palestinian flags. In Tucson, Arizona, a synagogue was vandalized. The ADL also reported thousands of tweets or retweets that seemed to echo the phrase, "Hitler was right." Last week, five Jewish organizations, including the ADL, wrote a letter to President Biden about their concerns over this rise in these hateful attacks, asking him to speak out more forcefully against them. For more on all of this, we turn to Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. Jonathan, great to see you back on the NewsHour. In the past, your organization has documented that when there is violence between Israelis and Palestinians, that anti-Semitic attacks in the U.S. go up. Compared now to then, are we seeing more now?
Yes, it's certainly true that in the past, conflagrations in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians or its neighbors have created or catalyzed an uptick of anti-Semitism in America. But what we're seeing now is more drastic and, frankly, more dangerous. The ADL tracked between the 2 weeks of the conflict and the 2 weeks before a 63% increase. And that surge is far greater than what we've seen in prior incidents, like 2014, for example. But what I'd also note is not just the quantitative, but the qualitative. The span of these attacks, they spread like wildfire across the country. You mentioned a few: California, Arizona, Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, New York, New Jersey, South Carolina, Florida. Acts of harassment and vandalism and violence. So number one, the span is much greater than what we've seen. But secondly, the tone, the brazenness, the audacity of these assaults in broad daylight. You know, we've seen people basically say, you know, if you're wearing a Jewish star, you must be a Zionist and you should be killed. We've seen people hurling bottles and objects at homes with mezuzot on the doors that were identifiably Jewish. We've seen people driving their cars or marauding through Jewish neighborhoods and yelling, "We're going to rape your women," right? Or yelling things like "Allahu Akbar," and literally then wreaking physical violence on people. And one of the incidents that was captured was in broad daylight in Times Square, a group of people beating and bloodying a Jewish man whose only crime was he was wearing a kippah, to the point where he was left unconscious in the street while people kicked him, you know, bloodied him with like a crutches. It was really quite disgusting. And to think that this is happening in America is really unconscionable.
So what do you attribute this to? I remember back during the Trump administration, you were quick to point out instances where you thought political language that fomented anti-Semitism. Do you see political leaders now who are exacerbating this?
Well, let's be clear. None of the people committing these crimes were wearing MAGA hats, right? The reality is I do believe that political language can have real world consequences, but this is a very different kind of political language. So yes, we called out the prior president and his kind of acolytes, the extremists, from marching in Charlottesville to marauding through Capitol Hill. But in this case, we have people waving Palestinian flags and then beating Jewish people. And in this case, you know, what I might really draw a parallel to is the hate crimes committed against Asian Americans, where unhinged, you know, fictionalized conspiracies about China, first spouted by political leaders, led to real-world consequences as Asian Americans were attacked on the streets. Well, today we have unhinged, fictionalized conspiracies about Israel, that somehow the Jewish state is systematically slaughtering children or committing genocide. And then that leads to real-world attacks on Jewish people in the streets of America, on our campuses, in our communities. So although, again, the political tenor may be different, the real outcome is the same. And that's why we think people, regardless of where you are on the spectrum, need to speak out clearly and firmly and forcefully and say in an unambiguous way that anti-Semitism is unacceptable. Because, again, this isn't activism. It's hate. And it should be called out as such.
In that letter that you sent to the White House, you specifically asked President Joe Biden to speak out more forcefully. Have you heard from the White House since you sent them that letter?
We have been in touch with the White House. Look, and Joe Biden has been good on these issues his entire career, from his time in the Senate to vice president to now as president. He announced his run for office, decrying the anti-Semitism that he saw, you know, in full view at Charlottesville. So just this morning, he tweeted out a firm statement we were pleased about. But we do think it's critical for the administration to stand squarely in solidarity with the Jewish community in this moment when so many of us are feeling frightened. I've heard from Jewish people across the country, and they are feeling scared. They have extremists on the right. They now have these, if you might say, radical voices from the left. And they are wondering, is it safe for me to go out, you know, wearing a kippah? Is it safe for me to walk to synagogue on a Saturday morning? Again, this is in America in 2021. So we think leaders, not just President Biden, but members of Congress need to speak out and clearly and consistently call it anti-Semitism without making equivalence or excuses for any other form of prejudice. You can have fierce debates about Middle East policy, but that is not an excuse to assault and victimize Jewish people in America, in Europe, anywhere.
All right, Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, thank you very much for being here.
You're dirt. We think you're dirt, Paul.
Who is we?
The West, all the superpowers, everything you believe in, Paul. They think you're dirt, they think you're dumb, you're worthless.
I'm afraid I don't understand what you're saying, sir.
Oh, come on, don't bullshit me, Paul. You're the smartest man here. You got them all eating out of your hands. You could own this freaking hotel, except for one thing. You're black. You're not even a nigger. You're an African.
In 1904, German troops were sent into what was then Southwest Africa to put down a rebellion against colonial rule. Over the next 4 years, tens of thousands were killed, including women and children. 80,000 of the indigenous Herero population and half the Nama people were wiped out. The skulls of slaughtered tribesmen were taken back to Germany to promote theories of racial superiority. The effects of the massacres continue today in what is now Namibia, but Germany has long refused to pay reparations. Today, the German Foreign Minister, Heiko Maas, said his country was making a first step towards taking responsibility.
Unser Ziel ist es, einen gemeinsamen Weg zu echter Versöhnung im Angedenken an die Opfer zu finden.
It is our aim to find a real common path to reconciliation in memory of the victims. Part of it is to clearly recognize the events during Germany's colonial past in what today is Namibia, and especially the atrocities between 1904 and 1908. Today, we officially describe these events as what they were, a genocide. With this, we also acknowledge our historic responsibility.
I asked our Africa editor, Mary Harper, for reaction in Namibia, but first she told me more about the action of the German troops there more than a century ago.
During this four-year period between 1904 and 1908, following an uprising that was started by the Herero people and then joined by the Hama, the Germans, especially a particular German general, basically launched, he launched an extermination order against these two ethnic groups. And they, many of them were killed, as you said. Many more were driven across as they fled. They fled across the Kalahari Desert, about 80,000 of them. And by the time they basically reached the other side, only 15,000 of them were left. Also, the Germans beheaded people who'd been killed, took their skulls to Germany to conduct scientific research on them, which they thought proved that black people were inferior to white people. They've started returning some of these bones already, but basically it was, as the Germans have now acknowledged, a genocide.
And it did indeed change the makeup of the population. The effects still felt today. What's been the reaction to this acceptance of the fact that it was a genocide?
The Herero people have actually not been very happy with this. The paramount chief said he said that this was absolutely not enough, that he was very disappointed. What he wanted is to have reparations from the Germans. And actually the Namibian authorities as well, the government spokesman has said that this is a first step in what will be a longer process, whereby eventually they hope that reparations will be paid. But at the same time, there's more than $1 billion have been offered by Germany over a 30-year period, which is supposed to be spent on development projects aimed at these two communities. But they don't see that as anything like enough, given what they suffered.
Our Africa editor, Mary Harper.
White supremacy is the sickness.
About half of the U.S. population is now fully vaccinated against COVID-19. And key to that figure is a surge in Latinos in the U.S. getting a vaccine. That group had been trailing the vaccination rate for white people in the U.S. by 9%. And now that gap has been cut in half. But the gains are spotty, and there are places that still report big gaps between Latino and white people. NPR member station reporters in Texas and Arizona are here now to tell us what they're seeing. Ashley Lopez at KUT in Austin and Catherine Davis-Young at KJZZ in Phoenix. Welcome.
Hey there.
Hello.
Hi. So Ashley, let's start with you. Tell us what's going on in Austin right now.
So for weeks now in Austin, about 19% of the total number of city residents who've been vaccinated have been Latino, even though they make up about a third of the population. And this is a worry because Latinos have been more likely to be hospitalized and die from the virus. They also make up a disproportionate share of Austin's frontline workers. This means they're less likely to get paid time off to get a vaccine or time to recover from its side effects. Some folks work multiple jobs and simply don't have time to even figure out where to get a vaccine. And Paul Saldana with the Austin Latino Coalition told me about another issue. About 20% of Latinos here don't have access to Wi-Fi or the internet, which early on was a big issue because online was the main way to get an appointment for the vaccine.
So, you know, anytime you have a system that's based on the internet or Wi-Fi, inevitably our people are going to have challenges.
So at least in the Austin area, this remains a problem. But I will say the state as a whole looks a little different. According to state health officials, about 40% of the people who have gotten at least one dose of the vaccine are Latino. That's up from about 26% in February.
Oh, that's so interesting, that discrepancy between Austin and the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. And Catherine, what's the story in Arizona?
Well, there's been a pretty wide gap between white and Latino vaccination rates here since the beginning, and it actually continues to grow, according to data from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Right now, about 40% of white Arizonans have had at least one dose of a vaccine, but among Latino Arizonans, it's only about 19%. That's a much larger gap than nationwide, and Arizona is far behind the Latino vaccination rates in neighboring New Mexico or California.
So let me just make sure I understand. Is it the same story in Arizona as it is in Texas? This idea that people are having trouble not only making time for, but getting to vaccination sites?
Well, it seems that way. Several people I've spoken with have pointed out to me that the state has really emphasized these big mass vaccination sites, drive-through style at football stadiums and fairgrounds. More than a quarter of all vaccines in our state have been administered at those big sites, but only 7% of people who have gone to those sites have been Hispanic or Latino. Dr. Joanna Andujar is with Mountain Park Health in Maryvale, which is a predominantly Latino section of Phoenix.
A lot of our community doesn't have a car. They have to depend on buses, public transportation, and walking here. And it's tough when they also have to work.
Well, then what's being done to get around those sorts of barriers and to make it easier for people to actually get vaccinated?
Well, Arizona's State Health Department Director, Dr. Kara Crist, says the state is making efforts to reach lower-income Latino communities.
We are doing telephonic town halls in both English and Spanish. We are doing door-to-door canvassing, yard signs.
The health department has also hired taxis to drive people to a state-run vaccination site, and they've coordinated with Spanish-speaking church leaders to promote vaccination. They say those efforts are getting some results, but some people I've talked to just say these things didn't happen early enough. For example, the state health department vaccination registration website wasn't translated into Spanish until 2 months into the state's vaccination campaign.
Wow. Okay, well, what about Austin, Ashley? How much of an effort does there seem to be to get around these obstacles to try and boost the vaccination rate for Latinos?
Well, you know, local officials in Austin have said they are really concerned about the Latino vaccination rates, and they're working on creating more targeted events in those communities. But Paul Saldana with the Austin Latino Coalition says this is work that really should have been done months ago.
I think we've done a poor job in making sure that we've reached our vulnerable populations during this COVID pandemic and getting them equitable access to the vaccines.
Saldana says his group, which typically advocates for Latino families in Austin, is now pulling together vaccine events of their own to try to get Latinos more shots.
I mean, how much do both of you feel that public officials are taking responsibility for these obstacles that still exist?
Well, in Austin, our mayor pro tem, Natasha Harper Madison, acknowledges that the numbers should be better and should have been better earlier. She says health officials need to be more proactive with messaging and they need to reach out to more communities with those lower vaccination rates.
We can't be passive about it. We can't just put out the word and hope that arms will come to us. We have to go to where the arms are in a lot of ways. And so I think we need to be considerably more proactive, more full court press.
Well, what about vaccine hesitancy? Are we seeing more hesitancy among Latino people than, say, among people in the U.S. generally?
This is Catherine in Phoenix. So, in fact, there was a recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll that showed among unvaccinated people, Latinos were more than twice as likely than whites to say they wanted the vaccine as soon as possible. And a researcher I spoke to there says it's the obstacles like transportation and language barriers that really do play a much larger role here.
Right. Okay. Well, as we continue to track progress, I mean, we should note that race and ethnicity data around vaccines is not perfect. Let's just talk about those imperfections.
Right. Nationally, the CDC says that race or ethnicity of people being vaccinated is only known about half the time. And most of that racial and ethnic data is self-reported. In Arizona, for example, just about 30% of race data for vaccines was either marked other or was unknown. And not every state reports that information in the same way.
That is Catherine Davis-Young at KJZZ in Phoenix and Ashley Lopez with member station KUT in Austin. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On page 59 of my book, there's a photograph. And the caption of that photograph, or what's scribbled on that photograph, is "Running the Negro Out of Tulsa." Mm. And it's a photograph that shows or depicts black residents from afar looking on as Greenwood burned in the background. And so whoever created this photograph certainly had in mind not just destroying the community, but in fact expelling black people, not just from the Greenwood district, but from Tulsa.
On May 31st, 1921, almost exactly 100 years ago, a group of white residents launched an attack on a thriving black neighborhood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Beginning that evening and continuing into the following day, white mobs stormed into black homes and schools and businesses. The Tulsa Race Massacre was one of the worst incidents of racial violence in American history. Today, we revisit a story from Radio Diaries, the story of a witness to that day. She was 6 years old at the time of the massacre.
My name is Olivia J. Hooker. The black part of Tulsa was a neighborhood where you could be treated with respect. My father had a very nice store, Samuel D. Hooker and Son. It was a store that didn't carry shoddy things. They had Arrow shirts, Kuppenheimer suits, Florsheim shoes, and Stetson hats. And those were all good names in those days. It was May 31st, 1921. At first, we saw a bunch of men with those big pine torches come through the backyard. And I remember our mother put us under the table. She took the longest tablecloth she had to cover four children and told us not to say a word. It was a horrifying thing for a little girl that's only 6 years old, trying to remember to keep quiet so they wouldn't know we were there. As those marauders came into the house, they were trying to destroy anything that they could find. They took a huge axe and started whacking at my sister Irene's beloved piano. Whack, whack, whack. It was a good piano, and they thought that was something we shouldn't have. When they left, they went on, you know, to do more damage to people who lived beside us and down the hill. They tried to destroy every black business, school, and church. Our school, Dunbar School, was blasted with dynamite, and my father's store was destroyed. I mean, there was nothing left but one big safe. It was so big they couldn't carry it away, so they had to leave it in the middle of the rubble. To me, I guess the most shocking thing was seeing people to whom you had never done anything to irritate, who just took it upon themselves to destroy your property because they didn't want you to have those things, and they were teaching you a lesson. Those were all new ideas to me. But I guess that's part of the growing up process. After the riot, we didn't stay in Tulsa. We moved to Topeka. Our parents tried to tell us, don't spend your time agonizing over the past. They encouraged us to look forward and think how you could make things better. I think things can get better, but maybe it won't be in a hurry.
In the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, more than 1,000 homes and businesses were destroyed, and it's estimated that as many as 300 people were killed. Olivia Hooker went on to become the first African-American woman to join the U.S. Coast Guard, and she helped form the Tulsa Race Riot Commission in 1997. She died in 2018, just 6 months after this story originally aired. She was 103 years old. Last week, three more survivors testified before a congressional subcommittee that's considering reparations for survivors of the massacre and their descendants. This story was produced by Nellie Gillis, with help from Sarah Kate Kramer and Joe Richman. It was edited by Deborah George and Ben Shapiro. You can hear an extended version on the Radio Diaries podcast.
Peace, quiet, and good order will be maintained in our city to the best of our ability. Riots, melees, and disturbances of the peace are against the interest of all our people, and therefore cannot be permitted.
In 2020, as the news of the death of George Floyd spread around the country, so did many peaceful protests calling for justice and police accountability.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
Some of those protests escalated into riots or were met with powerful police crackdowns. Now, 1 year later, there's a wave of legislation, especially in Republican-led state houses, adding new penalties for protesters who get out of line. And there are also bills that put limits on how and when and where people can gather. In Florida, the governor signed into law a measure he described as the strongest anti-looting, anti-rioting, pro-law enforcement piece of legislation in the country. Here to talk more is Blaze Ganey of member station WFSU in Tallahassee.
Hey, how you doing?
Katarina Sestarek of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Welcome to you as well.
Hi, Audie.
And to round this out, we're going to hear from a reporter from a state where there is a push to reinforce protesters' rights. Benta Berkland in Colorado of Colorado Public Radio, speaking to us from Denver. Welcome to you.
Hi, Audie.
Katarina, some 20 states are considering some version of an anti-protest or anti-disorder bill. Lawmakers in Iowa passed a protest bill last week nicknamed Back the Blue. What does it do? How does it compare to what we're seeing in other states?
The bill lawmakers passed here in Iowa has some similar themes with those passed in other states, and I've been talking to researchers who say that lawmakers will often target protest strategies that get the most media attention and draw the most attention to the message of the protesters, things like blocking highways and camping out by government buildings. In Iowa specifically, the bill raises penalties for offenses that can be related to protests, like rioting, unlawful assembly, obstructing streets and sidewalks. This bill also makes it a felony to damage any public property and makes it illegal to walk on a highway, something that protesters did in Iowa last summer. And it gives immunity to some drivers who hit protesters. That part is narrowly written, but it's concerning for some in that it's coming after a lot of protesters across the country were hit by cars last summer.
So, Blaze, I want to talk about what's happening in Florida as well. How different is this from what Katarina is describing in Iowa?
So mostly everything being done in Iowa is also part of the new law changes here. Some things I didn't hear Katarina mention in Iowa's version is a new criminal charge created by Florida's law. It's called aggravated rioting. It gives people in groups of 25 or more a felony for causing bodily harm, property damage upwards of $5,000, threatening or attempting to use a deadly weapon, and endangering motorists. The new law upset many because if one person gets out of line or out of character, the whole protest, all protesters, will then be arrested. Additionally, the new law would punish cities who decrease funding to their law enforcement, and it was seen as a direct response from Governor Ron DeSantis to the defund the police motto that was heard during a lot of protests last summer. During a press conference to promote the new law, Governor Ron DeSantis made it very clear who the law aims to protect.
Anybody who wears the uniform in service of protecting the public, this bill will make very clear, the state of Florida stands with you.
Benta, I want to talk about what's going on in a state like yours, right? You're in Denver, and you're hearing, I guess, sort of opposite messaging than what we're hearing, say, in Florida, as we just heard in that cut from Governor DeSantis. What are lawmakers trying to do in Colorado?
Absolutely. That's right. Democrats control the legislature here, and they actually had a bill that would have tried to protect protesters and First Amendment rights. So it tried to set limits on when law enforcement could disperse a crowd. But the main sponsor, Senator Jeff Bridges, has now changed that bill into a study to get more support for it. He says the goal is still to improve how law enforcement responds to that gray area between a peaceful protest and a riot. And so he said he knows that this happens, that a small group of people show up at a protest intending to break windows, cause damage, violence. He thinks police should be able to isolate those individuals while still protecting the First Amendment rights of everyone else who is at that protest.
There's such a political divide in this country looking at the events of the last year. What's been the reaction to these proposals, to these new laws? Katerina, let's start in Iowa.
Different law enforcement groups in Iowa say that they appreciate the support from lawmakers, and Republican lawmakers say they ran on backing the blue, and that's what they're doing with this bill. But Iowans who are pushing for racial justice didn't see any progress out of this past legislative session. Last summer, about 2 weeks into widespread protests in Des Moines, the legislature unanimously passed a police accountability bill that included a ban on police chokeholds in most cases, and leaders from both parties promised to do more on policing and criminal justice reform. State Representative Roz Smith, a Democrat, led that effort. And during debate on this bill that has protest restrictions in it, he mentioned people killed by police officers, and he asked Republican leaders why they made promises and didn't deliver this year.
Just because you've chosen to turn your back on the hard work doesn't mean that I will. I'm naive enough to keep pushing forward. I'm so afraid to become a Drew Edwards or a George Floyd moment that I cannot conceive stopping my pursuit to help us find a more perfect union.
Smith has said this bill feels like retaliation for progress made last summer.
Yeah, Katerina, similar to what Ross Smith was saying there, Democrats felt the same way here, and advocates for free speech and students were also upset with the legislation. While law enforcement officers and other first responders were probably happy for the bill, along with the passage of the bill, each first responder in the state receives a $1,000 bonus during the upcoming fiscal year. And as there's been pushback all along, as soon as the bill was signed, the ACLU and NAACP filed a lawsuit saying it was unconstitutional and also dissuades protesters from exercising their right to free speech.
Benta, you were at the State House, as we said, in Denver. How are people reacting there?
Well, Colorado has really been focusing on criminal justice reform, not on protesters or protests per se. Last summer, the state passed a sweeping law enforcement accountability measure, and that had almost universal support. And it requires body cameras and gets rid of qualified immunity for law enforcement, among a host of other things. But I would say that new proposals this session to limit how often arrests result in jail time and better defined use of force have run into significantly more opposition from Republicans and law enforcement. The partisan differences have deepened in part because of the national political climate over the last few months. And then also Colorado saw an escalating crime rate in virtually every category.
That was Benta Berkland of Colorado Public Radio in Denver. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Blaze Ganey of member station WFSU in Tallahassee. Thank you, Blaze.
Thank you.
Katerina Sestarek of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Katerina, thank you.
Thank you.
Did you say you saw someone steal a police horse this week?
I'll send you the video, Gus. I sent it to the firefighter. All-time classic. It might have topped when they pulled Reginald Barry out the car. Reginald Barry out the car. I mean, this was I'm going to send it to you. His brothers had his black cow with this, and they're like, "Where'd you get the police?"
They stole the police. Come on. I'm wounded.
From the police.
I'm wounded. I'm wounded. I'm totally wounded. That's
Chicago.
Gus, I just want to report that stealing the cowboy, stealing the horse, was a false report. The guy who was videotaped, he actually owned that horse, and he was falsely accused of stealing a police horse. And basically got his car spray painted, saying, "Return the horse." Yeah. So that was a false report.
I can't do it.
1 year ago today, George Floyd died under the knee of a police officer, and protests erupted worldwide. Support surged for Black Lives Matter, a movement that began with an online hashtag, and today there's still lots of support for the movement online. Posts on social media continue to call for racial justice and an end to police brutality. But there are also posts
that are riddled with disinformation. Activists charge that's part of an overall effort to undermine Black Lives Matter and its message. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
Log on to a social media account and there's a myriad of posts about Black Lives Matter, including plenty of disparaging ones, like this one that falsely claims the government has identified it as a terrorist group. Another that circulated widely claimed that BLM activists had badly beaten a group of elderly white people. That post has been debunked by fact checkers who found the photos were taken in South Africa years ago, and it has been taken down. However, Jordan Geiger, an organizer with Black Lives Matter in Indiana, says there's still plenty of disinformation online designed to cause confusion and distrust.
Like reports circulating that BLM is going to vandalize businesses in downtown areas, that we are targeting specific white communities, those kinds of things. It makes our supporters say, okay, I don't want to get involved in that, right? And so when disinformation just goes unchecked, folks will believe it if you don't get ahead of it or respond to it appropriately.
Geiger says that's why BLM launched an effort to stop disinformation and urges people to send in details about suspicious posts or stories to the Black Lives Matter website. When Black Palante, a nonpartisan group created after the 2016 presidential election, also monitors disinformation aimed at people of color, hundreds of organizers across the country formed a digital war room during last year's election. They tracked bots that automatically send out scripted disinformation, often from Russia or other foreign governments trying to sow discord in the U.S., and they tracked what are known as digital blackface accounts that steal images to masquerade as Black people and spread disinformation. Ashley Bryant, one of the co-leaders of When Black Palante, says they also found conspiracy theories about Black Lives Matter.
That went everything from George Floyd not being dead to, you know, George Soros funding protests, and then the full-out attacks on Black Lives Matter, where there's foreign actors, there's fake accounts pretending to be Antifa, all to actually just build this violent narrative around Black Lives Matter.
University of North Carolina professor Dean Freeland studies digital politics. He points to specific instances of disinformation about Black Lives Matter protesters engaging in violence.
There was a false story about a Black Lives Matter allied protester setting fires in Oregon, so connecting to the wildfires there. The claim that Black Lives Matter is white-led. There has been some Spanish language disinformation.
Freeland says Twitter has been vigilant about rooting out state-sponsored disinformation from foreign actors. Facebook says it's taken several steps, too, including working with nonpartisan and independent fact-checkers to root out the spread of fake stories. Information proven to be false can be removed for violating social media standards. That's not the case when it comes to posts online that are technically considered an opinion. Freeland says that's harder to combat.
Examples there include things like the notion that BLM is anti-white, which, of course, is an opinion, that it is a hate group, that it's somehow anti-family, that it is morally equivalent to far-right groups. And then there are some things that kind of blur the line between fact and opinion.
Critics of Black Lives Matter say it's the movement's supporters that are getting duped.
I feel that Black Lives Matter is one of the greatest sources of this information.
Mike Gonzalez is a senior fellow with the Heritage Foundation. He's the author of an upcoming book about Black Lives Matter and Marxism.
They have good Americans, well-intentioned Americans, who do not want to see racial injustice, and rightly so, putting up signs on their lawn about Black Lives Matter. They have manipulated the good nature of many people who think what they're doing, in my view, is trying to promote a philosophy that is not going to be good for this country, will destroy this country, and will destroy our way of life.
And then right-wing pundits like Rudy Giuliani, Candace Owens, and Carol Swain amplify often baseless anti-BLM messages to wider audiences.
Black Lives Matter wants to come and take your house away from you. They want to take your property away from you.
Yeah. Far-left, crazy Antifa thugs who know exactly what they're doing.
Using Black people to advance a Marxist agenda.
On our YouTube channel, Patrice Khan Cullors, one of the three co-founders of Black Lives Matters, responds.
I need to set the record straight. Am I a Marxist?
Khan Cullors says she does believe in Marxism, but laughs at the online comments that say she's pushing a communist agenda.
I'm working on making sure that people don't suffer. I'm working to make sure people don't go hungry. And These comments that I've received have been incredibly hurtful. It means that so many people aren't really taking our work very seriously.
The dean of the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard, Tomiko Brown-Nagin, says some of the disinformation surrounding Black Lives Matter could be from the old-style anti-civil rights playbook of the 1960s. Brown-Nagin says the FBI, under J. Edgar Hoover and segregationists, repeatedly used disinformation in an attempt to besmirch that movement.
So opponents characterize activists as lawbreakers or as violent when overwhelmingly they were nonviolent. Martin Luther King Jr. and members of his inner circle were said to be communists or communist sympathizers.
And like the civil rights movement back then, Black Lives Matter has seen its support both rise and decline after months of protests and the conviction of former police officer Derek Chauvin. While polls show a large majority of African Americans continue to back the movement, overall support has dropped from record levels seen after George Floyd's death. How much of that loss is due to disinformation is difficult to measure, but what's certain is the battle over controlling what people believe about Black Lives Matter and its influence is ongoing. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago. All around the
world. This is Sasha Johnson, a prominent anti-racism campaigner. She's fighting for her life in hospital after reportedly being shot in the head. The incident happened in Southwark in southeast London. Police were called to an address on Consort Road behind me at just after 3 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. It is there, they say, they found a 27-year-old woman who had suffered from a gunshot wound. Detectives from the Metropolitan Police's Specialist Crime Command are leading the investigation. In a statement, the Met says, "While the investigation is at an early stage, there is nothing to suggest the woman who was shot was the subject of a targeted attack or that she had received any credible threats against her prior to this incident." Last August, Sasha Johnson organised a large-scale march to protest against systemic racism. She told Sky News what drives her activism.
The UK disassociates from racism, but we have to remember the Windrush generation came here. When we're funding war to bomb other countries and people are coming here for safety and rest, then we're fleeing them away for our xenophobia. So we're not disassociating from it. We're saying yes is here, but we need to address it now. We're in 2020. We've come too far for racism to still be a problem.
The 27-year-old mother is a committee member of the political party taking the initiative. The party says, "It is with great sadness that we inform you that our own Sasha Johnson has sustained a gunshot wound to her head. Sasha has always been actively fighting for black people and the injustices that surround the black community." So far, there have been no arrests. Police are appealing to anyone with any information to come forward. Jemima Walker, Sky News.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
Talking today with our legal roundtable. That includes Nicole Gorofsky. She's a former prosecutor, now in private practice at Gorofsky Law. We're also joined by Eric Banks, a former state prosecutor and city councilor for the city of St. Louis. He's now in private practice at Banks Law. And last but not least, Bill Freivogel, a journalism professor at Southern Illinois University Carbondale, as well as an attorney. And we're going to turn now to a high-profile case involving some bad cops. A month ago, a St. Louis jury deadlocked on charges against former police officers Dustin Boone and Christopher Myers. They were accused of beating an undercover colleague, Luther Hall. Now federal prosecutors are planning to retry both of them. And earlier this month, prosecutors filed a motion with new evidence they plan to use in the case. That includes some incendiary text messages. The defense attorneys for these former officers were not happy about this. And one of the arguments they made in trying to say that prosecutors should face sanctions and that these should not be allowed to use, they pointed out that some of these text messages were between former officer Dustin Boone and his then girlfriend. Well, Dustin Boone and his girlfriend got married. They got married about a year after this beating incident. And prosecutors are saying they can use this. Defense attorneys are saying they can't. Nicole, why is this even an issue here? How does the law work?
Well, there actually is a marital privilege in Missouri, which has always seemed a little strange to me, but it does exist. And so married people can't be compelled to testify against each other. Now, the text messages exist and they're out there in the world. And I don't think the marital privilege covers the fact that the text messages exist. And so I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is that if them getting married at this point can prevent the girlfriend then becoming the wife from testifying. I think that if you can present evidence that the marriage is fraud solely for that purpose, I think is what the prosecutor is saying, that negates the marital privilege. I think I'm not sure how the court will come down on that issue. That's an interesting argument.
Yeah, I mean, they're making the argument of the forfeiture by wrongdoing rule is what the prosecutors are saying here. They're basically saying that he only married her to prevent her from testifying. It seems like they'd have to bring in a bunch of evidence before you could say that about a marriage. Eric, is that a tough hill to climb?
Well, they call this practice of law for a reason. I've never heard of the marital privilege being extended to a time frame even before you were married. So what's up with that? Are we going to have next a fiancé privilege? And in addition to that, if I can get on my high horse for a minute. I think that anybody who believes that there is a reasonable expectation of either privacy or confidentiality with any type of text message needs to have his or her head examined. Well, I would like to think that I am many things, but stupid is not one of them. Well, not excessively stupid anyway. And I would never put in a text anything that I wouldn't want to read about or hear about on St. Louis on the Air.
You know, and some of these texts were just horrible. I mean, we're kind of laughing about the stupidity of putting these things in writing. But there were some appalling racist sentiments in these texts and just frank talk about beating people up, trying to avoid cameras while beating people up. After federal prosecutors included these texts in a brief that was available to reporters, the Post-Dispatch ran a story. The Riverfront Times actually put them on the cover of the newspaper. And defense attorneys are saying these are inflammatory, they're irrelevant, and highly prejudicial. They do seem quite inflammatory. Bill Freivogel, do these guys have a right to keep these under wraps, at least as far as the jury is concerned? I mean, frankly, I wanted to convict these guys after reading these texts.
Yeah, I was ready to convict them before I read the text. But no, I don't think they can keep these texts away. And you know, what I read from a piece that Lauren Traeger has on KMOV, the judge doesn't think they can either. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem to be too impressed by the defense arguments. I mean, in one of these texts, I believe it's Boone, refers to the circuit attorney as a platelip. You know, as long as the platelips are in charge of the circuit attorney's office. I mean, and this is just horrible, gross.
Yeah, I actually feel bad that we just even said that on the air. I mean, it is horrible. And
it is so horrible. Yeah. It is. Maybe I shouldn't have said it.
Well,
but that's what we're talking about here. And you know, these messages are also, I mean, they're not just, you know, to rile up a jury, although I suppose they could do that. But one of the things that in a federal civil rights case that has to be proven is willfulness to violate somebody's civil rights. And certainly these go a long way towards doing that.
So Bill mentioned this story from KMOV. They reported yesterday that a judge has ruled that the text messages containing racial slurs can be used in that trial. KMOV also reported the judge also ruled prosecutors will get to call Dustin Boom's now wife to testify on the stand. After ruling there was evidence, he married her just to prevent her from testifying. The judge, however, said the evidence about Boone and drugs, because there was also a lot of talk about apparently using drugs right before going on shift, he said that evidence will not be allowed at trial. Nicole, thoughts on all this?
Yeah, I mean, I always find it interesting if you're caught in a position of arguing that something is so inflammatory and so incendiary. But the problem is your clients are the ones that actually said those things. I think you're in a bad position. I mean, as the defense attorneys, right? I mean, you're trying to prevent public acknowledgement of something that your clients actually did. And it looked like the defense attorneys were actually seeking sanctions from of the prosecutors for putting this in pleadings. And I mean, these are pleadings, and the, you know, the prosecutors have to do what they have to do to get the information into court. And, you know, so, you know, if you can't, you know, if you can't handle what you said, don't say it.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem, Eric, that this speaks to this issue of intent.
Yes, I agree. Admittedly, I got D's when I studied Latin at Lutheran North. I guess I was cheating off the wrong person. But there is a Latin phrase, which I don't remember and certainly cannot pronounce, that talks about the state of mind. And the state of mind is an element of the crime. So it is not sufficient that somebody has been injured. You have to prove, the prosecutor has to prove, that the defendant intended the result. And I believe that these text messages allow that to happen.
And in federal civil rights cases, that require the amount that has to be proven in terms of willfulness is even greater than just the norm in normal criminal cases. You know, one thing that came out yesterday, according to this KMOV report, there was an injury report written involving Luther Hall's injuries. And the report reminds me of the one that's gotten a lot of attention involving George Floyd. This injury report by the St. Louis police said, as officers were making arrests, Officer Hall was knocked to the ground, striking the concrete.
The passive voice there is, wow.
Recent attacks in this country against Asian Americans have been met with condemnation across the political spectrum and support from other communities of color, including Black Americans. Stephanie Tsai has a look at the state and history of those relationships.
Judy, the recent show of solidarity among Black and Asian American activists belies a fraught history between these groups. For example, during the 1992 riots in Los Angeles, racial tensions exploded, with armed Korean American shopkeepers facing off against rioters. A year before the brutal police beating of Rodney King, which set off the uprising, a Korean shop owner had fatally shot a 15-year-old Black girl, Latasha Harlins, for allegedly trying to steal a bottle of juice. Then, more recently, a Hmong American Minneapolis police officer, To Tao, was one of four officers accused of standing by while Derek Chauvin knelt on George Floyd's neck. Both communities are now working urgently toward greater racial and social justice. The question is, how might they work side by side? I'm joined by Tamara Knopper, a sociologist and fellow at New York University's Center for Critical Race and Digital Studies, and Brenda Stevenson, a professor of history and African American studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Ladies, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour for this important conversation. And Professor Stevenson, I want to start with you, because the last time I interviewed you, we talked about how a broad racial coalition had emerged after the killing of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement growing. As we started to see these increased attacks on Asian Americans, I wonder, do you feel that solidarity held, or are there still those fractures among communities of color that we saw in Los Angeles nearly three decades ago?
Well, I think that answer to that question is both things have occurred. I think the solidarity is certainly holding. Many people who are in the African American or African diaspora community, including my family, have been very much supportive of the Stop Asian Hate movement. And I know many people who are. And then there are other people who have not been. And indeed, some of the people who have been accused of being a part of this attack on, or this increased attack on Asian Americans have been African American. So both things are happening. We're seeing that the solidarity is not only holding, but growing, but there are also other problems, other kinds of tensions and conflicts that are there that are still being maintained as well.
Professor Stevenson brings up the fact that a small number of the perpetrators of attacks on Asian Americans have been other people of color, including African Americans, although the data shows the vast majority of those attacks have been white perpetrators. But Tamara Knapper, I wonder how you see the dynamics between the Asian and Black communities in the U.S. in this moment.
Thank you. Well, on one hand, I think that there's this kind of increased call for coalition. And I think that more Asian Americans as individuals, activists, Asian American organizations are starting to kind of publicly talk about anti-Black racism and about Asian Americans confronting anti-Blackness. I think one of the ongoing tensions, though, is that a lot of solidarity discourse and solidarity discourse that non-Black people of color communities, not only Asian Americans, but you see this with other non-Black people of color groups, there's often this kind of disciplinary gesture involved in solidarity discourse, meaning there's often a lot of kind of anti-Black aggression. There's often a lot of assumptions that Black people need to, quote unquote, learn to be in coalition with other groups, or that Black people supposedly are politically selfish or are helping perpetrate harm or violence against non-Black people of color if they don't engage in solidarity. And so even as we're seeing this kind of increased emphasis on Black Asian solidarity and on non-Black people of color groups confronting anti-Blackness, I think there's a lot of tinges of anti-Blackness in the solidarity approaches from non-Black people of color that's still being perpetrated.
Professor Stevenson, you're a professor of history. I wonder from that lens, what forces you see at work that have sometimes pitted Blacks and Asians against each other in this country?
Well, I think part of it is that a lot of people don't know the history of African Americans or of Asian Americans within this community, within our country. And so, you know, African Americans sometimes don't understand that Asian Americans have had the same kinds or very similar kinds of discriminations against them and abuses against them because of their race. As well, sometimes Asian Americans do not understand that African Americans have been from day one racialized and criminalized and victimized in this country. And so there are miscues with regard to what we have in common and what we share. And this common relationship to white supremacy, a common relationship to marginalization, culturally and racially and all of that within the country. And so without this history, without knowing, you know, the kinds of histories in which we actually absolutely connect and have parallel or connect or have parallel lives in a nation that is partly defined by othering people who are not white American, then these difficulties are maintained. But that is changing. And more people are taking the time to understand that there is a connection, absolutely, with the plight of African Americans and the abuse of Asian Americans and white supremacy.
Tamara Knapper, what are your thoughts on that phrase, white supremacy, and how the system and the world that we all live in, a society where racial discrimination has shaped all of us, where Asian Americans fit in that equation?
Thank you. Well, I think there's, you know, there's always been this ongoing debate in Asian American spaces, whether it's Asian American studies or activist spaces, you know, about this kind of idea that Asian Americans are perceived as either honorary whites or so-called model minorities, or are we really kind of embraced as part of a people of color coalition? And so there's also this question about what makes kind of a race a race. Is it just our politics? Is it the way we're kind of socially and politically structured in relationship to the state? So I think that, you know, the question about Asian Americans' relationship to whiteness, I think, is something that is a deep anxiety in Asian American discourse and politics. And I think that part of the issue is that we can think about what is our relationship to whiteness, but we also have to think about what is our relationship to blackness. Social scientists talk about this idea of a black non-black divide. And what they say is that it's not just about people's relationship to whiteness that makes a, you know, definitive factor in kind of their life chances, but it's also their relationship to blackness and how far they can actually be distanced from blackness. And so I think it's about not only thinking about white supremacy, but also Asian Americans' relationship to anti-black racism and anti-blackness.
Professor Stevenson, you know, you brought up again these anti-Asian attacks and the perpetrators, sometimes people of color. I wonder, how do we talk about violence within communities of color and between communities of color without reinforcing extremely damaging stereotypes? I mean, you wrote the book on Latasha Harlins, the 15-year-old that was killed in Los Angeles all those years back. How far have we really come?
Well, I think, again, it's a strange dance that we have with race in America. You know, we come forward with many steps, swirl around, and we're going in the opposite direction. So, you know, this continues to happen. But I think everyone has to own up to the fact that we live in a racialized society. The ways in which we find ourselves or define ourselves as being American in part is to have digested some of that racism. So no group does not have it. No group does not act on it. And we have to understand that. And we have to have some real hard discussions with ourselves, our families, our communities, and with other communities about, you know, how we fit into this dynamic of race within our society. Do we perpetuate racism, stereotypes, etc., or are we actively trying to recognize that we hold some of that within ourselves and that we act on it and we need to eliminate it, or at least get it to a level where we can all act towards one another with respect, dignity, and equality. But it's very, very difficult. It is bound in the roots of American society. And once you eat of the tree of America, it becomes part of you.
Mm. And the uprooting of all of that, I think, begins with conversations just like this. Professor Brenda Stevenson with UCLA and Tamara Knopper with New York University, thank you for joining the NewsHour.
Thank you.
This is dedicated to whom it may concern. To be a gifted and black.
Trauma is the biggest influencer of black mental health. We're talking about historical trauma, slavery, Jim Crow, the civil rights movement, the Tuskegee experiment, up until present day trauma.
Mental health advocate Philip Rountree, in his TEDx talk, pointed to the spate of police killings of unarmed black men as present-day trauma. This week will mark the one-year anniversary of George Floyd, murdered by the recently convicted former Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin. And Floyd's death was followed by several high-profile acts of racism, linked to trauma and measurable PTSD in communities of color. What role has the seemingly never-ending racial trauma played in the uptick of suicidal deaths among young African Americans? And why are some mental health specialists surprised the rate of suicides isn't higher? Joining me remotely, Diana Schlosser, Boston-based child family therapist. Hello, Diana.
Hello there.
Dr. Rita Walker, professor at the University of Houston Department of Psychology and author of The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. Hi, Dr. Walker.
Hello. It's good to be here.
And Joseph Feaster Jr., who lost his son to suicide and is both a council member at the Samaritans and executive committee member at the National Association of Mental Health here in Boston.
Welcome, Joseph.
Thank you very much, Callie. Glad to be here.
So one of the things I want to get on the table, Dr. Walker, is there are many contributing factors leading to suicide. So we none of us can point to one thing, but what we're doing in this conversation is talking about the contextual impact of racial trauma. But first, can you just address the fact that there are many contributing factors, not just one, that could potentially lead to any suicide?
Absolutely. I think that's an important place to start because so often we wonder what happened, what was the thing, what was the single thing that could have been prevented. And it's almost like we think about a car accident where there's two cars and maybe one person runs a stop sign and then that's the cause of the accident. But suicide is more like a multi-car event where there are different scenarios, various scenarios. Maybe there was someone who, you know, was driving too fast and maybe it was late at night and they hadn't slept well and maybe the roads were icy. But then maybe there was someone who was in an automobile that was, you know, that had better safety features. And so they were better protected. And so we have to pay attention to like the risks in the circumstances, but also the protective factors, because a lot of people have the exact same experience, but come away with different kinds of results. So that's one of the ways that I think it's important for us to think about how complex suicide really is as we're thinking about prevention and looking forward.
So why are we seeing or have been seeing an increase among Black youth specifically?
Well, I think that we have to think about the larger context always. And for Black people, there's always been this pervasive trauma, untreated mental health concerns and challenges and lack of access to care. But what has been the bridge or the buffer or the support has been the community and the level of connectedness to not just family and friends, but also religious environments and spirituality. And that is something that has been eroded in the last year or for the last 14 months, that there has been that lack of access to the buffers to the stressful life situations and circumstances that have happened. So I think that's it's a combination of factors. You know, it's the risk, the psychological risk, but also not having access to family and friends and being able to hug folks and laugh and talk about, you know, what's been going on in a way that has happened historically or pre-pandemic.
So Diana, let's talk about that context of the pandemic, because as we know, the pandemic, well, as we now know, because people are talking about it and people are coming forward to saying that they have suffered and that if they had mental health issues before, they were heightened during this period of isolation. That's for everybody. And then we have some startling statistics from the Pew Center, for example, that one in four young people had considered suicide, because this is just a really traumatic time. So from your perspective as a therapist, talk about what you were seeing with that context, how that context impacted your clients and what you were seeing.
Yes, it definitely has impacted kiddos and families across the board. I would say those protective factors that we were just talking about, we can't underestimate the impact of those in helping us to maintain our mental health and our mental well-being. And for a lot of kiddos who on the regular are dealing with disparities and racism and downstream effects of socioeconomic status, those protective factors are huge, right? And, you know, when we're thinking about specific places in the community, I think one of the biggest things that has really impacted kids was school closures, right? Oftentimes, school was the place where kiddos would have a soft landing spot and they would have, you know, a warm meal. And there was hope in their lives because of that particular interaction with adults in the school environment and also their peers. And so, yes, seeing that erode has significantly impacted kiddos and their families. And, you know, I would say the other key piece here, too, as it relates to the pandemic, is this idea of this chronic uncertainty that we've all been dealing with, right? And, you know, I often talk with kiddos and their families about the fact that stress is a normal part of life, but also a normal part of life typically is that stress dissipates over time. But that particular stress as it relates to the pandemic has been chronic and just unrelenting for the last year or so. And so that on top of everything else that kids of color in particular were already facing pre-pandemic has really made things extremely difficult.
Joseph Feaster, your son died before the pandemic and, of course, long before George Floyd was murdered. But, of course, as a young Black man, he lived in the racial environment. He was 19 when you realized he was suffering some mental health issues. But I wonder if you would first tell us if you were able to recognize, I mean, you're a Black man too, so, you know, some of these elements that we're talking about with regard to racial trauma also impact you. But were you able to recognize any of that impact on your son as he was sort of struggling initially?
Well, first, let me thank you very much, Callie. It's almost 10 and a half years now since his passing in 2010. The circumstances around Joseph, I think his was clinical. The first evidence of any issues regarding Joseph's mental health occurred when he was about 19 years old, when he returned from his first year at University of Pittsburgh.
And what did you see? And prior to that, was there anything that signaled to you that he was struggling?
No, there wasn't anything that signaled it until that summer when he returned from college. And even there, because of this view with colleges and its relationships to parents telling us that they can't disclose anything to us, there was no indication until I received a bill for extra cleaning of his room. And I inquired further and realized because he first had an episode when he returned from that summer and realized that there must have been episodes which occurred while he was away in Pittsburgh. There was no indication at all during his high school years. Academically, he was one of the marshals for his graduating class in terms of sports, social issues, played basketball. So it wasn't anything there. And then after the fact, what I do find is that you have a time period where one is in denial. He was not about to admit that he suffered from any mental illness. And I can tell you, I never really had a true diagnosis. The presumption is that he was bipolar, but never had a true diagnosis because he wasn't actually being treated by any psychiatrist or psychologist.
And so, Joseph, before I return to our experts here in the conversation with us, did you feel any stigma around the fact that you recognized eventually that your son had some mental health issues?
No, Callie, I see no stigma because I recognize, and this is what I preach to all caregivers, is that we're dealing with a situation where for so long in this society, we have not recognized that mental illness is an illness and that the brain is no different than, you know, illnesses of the heart or is illnesses of the liver, or illnesses of the kidney, where there is a need for treatment. So for me, there was no stigma, and because of that, many people, particularly in the Black community, reach out to me when they are confronted with an issue of a child or a relative, spouse who is evidencing mental illness and possible suicide tendencies, because I'm very vocal about it. And so I can say to you, mental illness is an illness, and suicide is one of the conditions that could occur as a result of one suffering from that illness.
I'm Callie Crossley, and you're listening to Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. My guests are Diana Schlosser, Boston-based child family therapist, Dr. Reader Walker, professor at the University of Houston, and Joseph Feaster Jr., mental health advocate in Boston. We're discussing racial trauma suffered by young African Americans and its link to suicide. So, Dr. Walker, back to you. You have talked about your theory about particularly middle-class Black Americans trying to cope with one of the multiple factors, as we discussed at the beginning of this conversation, that impact them and could put pressure leading to a potential suicide. Would you explain that, please?
So I wear a few different hats. I'm a professor of psychology at University of Houston and a licensed psychologist. And so I've been doing this work for the better part of 2 decades, trying to understand risk and resilience related to potential suicide outcomes for Black people. And I have to say, you know, Joseph, I really appreciate, you know, your work and what you have tried to do, even though I know it's not an organization you necessarily desire to be a part of, that you have been trying to get the word out, because I think that what happens for a lot of, say, upwardly mobile and middle-class Black people is that there is this drive to, you know, understandably work hard and do the best you can and not show any weakness and not show any vulnerability. And, you know, to tap into sometimes a higher power, you know, and recognizing that there have been many generations before the current generation, many generations who've struggled. And so, gosh, you know, do I have a right to even say I'm struggling emotionally? Especially when you are a high functioning, smart, high achieving individual, you know, it's like you just keep pressing through no matter what. And I have, in fact, through my research, looked at cultural identity and ethnic identity and the degree to which, like, the erosion of that, because, you know, we want to say that we're in much more of a melting pot, you know, that race doesn't matter as much as it did generations ago. But I think that that connection to what it means to be African-American or African of African descent, to be a Black American, that that's been part of the protection that I think Black people are losing because of this sense of, well, things just aren't as bad. We're some say it's post-racial. I know a lot of folks are realizing now we're not post-racial, but we don't have to have those kinds of connections, that they're not as important now. And I think that that's increased some of the vulnerability to mental health challenges and some instability.
And is it more helpful that it appears to be beginning to be recognized in a more contextual way? By that I mean, for example, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, have just declared that racism is a public health threat. Does that help people, you know, find their space in trying to understand how some of these young people could be probably more intensely impacted because of the reasons you just said?
It's a good question. I think it's a good start. It's a really good start. But one of the things that I'm convinced of is that we don't really know what racism is or what it means or the impact of it. And I spent 2 chapters in my book, The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. I dedicated 2 chapters to talking about the impact of racism because I think we're so conditioned to just deal with it. You know, it's like, yeah, there's racism in schools and there's racism in the police force and the banking system and the work setting. Like, you name it, it's everywhere. And Black folks have just kind of dealt with it. And so because we've dealt with it, I don't think we necessarily understand the impact of it. But over time, it becomes an incredible weight and an incredible burden. And then on the other side of that is, you know, the folks who are empowered, and I'm talking about white European Americans, who are more so empowered to dismantle racism, question that it exists. Like, so, you know, was that racist? Well, that wasn't racism, or you're being too sensitive. So I think we still have a really long way to go. I am glad that the CDC acknowledges it, but I think that as far as day-to-day conversations and understanding the impact and understanding how to undo racist systems, we have a really long way to go, unfortunately.
Diana, was there a point when you became cognizant that the rates of suicide among young African-Americans were ticking up?
Yeah, I mean, in keeping up with publications and research, you know, it's pretty clear. But then also, I would say anecdotally, you know, as a child and family therapist and nurse, one of the things that I would notice is that kiddos who were of African-American descent, who I would see, often ended up being hospitalized more than their counterparts for things like suicidal ideation. It was coming up a lot in therapy sessions, and it was something that I was working with a lot more families of color around how to navigate than the other kiddos who I was seeing. So I would say anecdotally, very much so.
So recognizing that any kind of long-term, well, even somewhat short-term impact, so that the real numbers about, you know, how much it's gone up after you have two intense events. And so I'm going to characterize the post-George Floyd set of racial incidents as one big event, and the other one, the context of the coronavirus pandemic and the lockdown. What would you anticipate now, based on what you've seen before, we might be seeing in terms of an increase in suicides among young African Americans?
Yeah, unfortunately, I would say that the numbers are trending and have been trending in a direction. And I would think that based on the two events that you've laid out, that there would be an exponential increase if we don't put things in place to help mitigate that risk. And what those things are, I think, varies. But, you know, as we're talking about suicidal risk and suicidal ideation, one of the biggest things for us clinicians is looking at what protective factors are available and in the community. And I think that, you know, leveraging the power of community relationships and the ways that people relate to one another is a great way to kind of help mitigate that, right? We have a shortage of mental health providers, and we know that access to mental health care, especially in Black communities, is really difficult. And so, you know, I think we need to start thinking of new ways to help leverage mental health and well-being in those communities, and to give the tools and resources that would be helpful to make sure that that does not, in fact, happen.
Joseph, understanding that people that you're out there trying to talk to people about this, that it happened to you, what have you seen in terms of this increase that's across the board, but particularly among African-American youth? And when you talk to people who are confused or puzzled or stigmatized, as you are not, what are they saying?
What I find amongst people when I'm speaking to them, and I'm a reassuring sense for them because of how I approach it, being that when I'm speaking to persons, particularly those who have had someone close to them who has committed suicide, I've walked in their shoes. So there's a respect factor that comes into play because we understand each other. For those who have yet to experience a suicidal event close to them, then it's a question of trying to give them, as we did recently with a program, give them the ability to see what some of the signs are. Like the question you posed to me earlier, were there any signs that I saw with regards to my son? Well, maybe there's a possibility. Unwittingly, I missed them. But now I'm more acutely in terms of, one, what signs to look for. We passed that along. How to approach the conversation in a way which is non-threatening, not only for the person possibly afflicted with mental illness, but also the caregiver. So we try to wrap ourselves around a very holistic approach by bringing in the clinical aspects, being a non-clinician, to let them know that I feel your pain, and these are some of the things that I employed in my dealings with a person who was either suffering with mental illness or has suicidal iterations. So that's how I've approached it in my work, and I will continue to do my work in that regard, because I think it's so valuable and so important. And there are, because of the denial that I see coming from particularly the communities of color, the Black and brown community, that mental illness doesn't exist. And I think that complicates the problem, and certainly has been exacerbated by what has happened as far as the poignantness of racism. And certainly, what I call it, the George Floyd era has definitely brought this home and has created a circumstance which I think has increased the possibilities of suicidal events going forward.
So, Joseph Feaster, what's the one thing you would tell in your message to Black people about suicide and about what we're seeing among young African Americans?
My word to them is, if you see something, then you need to begin to reach out as you would. The example that I always give, Callie, is this, that if I were to fall down and people were there, they would be talking about, give him room, let him breathe, let's call the doctor. If I started tearing off my clothes and start running around in a circle, they're going to call 911, but they're not calling for the doctor, they're calling for the police officer. So our reaction to a person experiencing mental illness is going to be different, and we need to begin to educate our people in that regard, that mental illness is an illness. So that's where I would start.
Okay. Diana, same question to you. What's the one thing that you want my listeners to understand about how to think about the rate of suicidal deaths going up among young African Americans against the context of this racial trauma?
I think one of the biggest things is this sense of safety. I think that is probably the biggest protective factor, and probably one of the protective factors that was very much disrupted by both COVID as well as witnessing some of these racial injustices and big events that have happened. So as much as we can foster a sense of safety and security for young Black kids, I think that we can help to mitigate that increase in suicidal ideation and risk.
Same question to you, Dr. Walker.
Yeah, I love everything that my fellow guests have mentioned so far. And one of the things that I always wonder about is people try to assume that if someone has considered suicide or thinking about suicide or who's died by suicide, that there's some level of crazy that's happened. And we have to let that go. And especially for our young people, that if we can take the position as grownups and as caregivers, that children are resilient, but they can also be vulnerable. And they need for us adults to step in sometimes and check in and say, you know, hey, how are you doing? You know, you don't seem like yourself today. Or for especially younger children, because we know that children as young as age 6 and 7 are dying by suicide, that we pay attention to their behavior. They may not have the language, but is there any shift in their behavior? Is there something stressful going on in their lives? That we pay attention, we get them the support that they need, that we ask questions. If they're an older child and they don't want to talk, that we let them know, I'm here to talk whenever you're ready. I just want to support you however you need to be supported. And we make sure that we're there when they do ask for that help or when they do suggest that they need it. I think those are some of the main things that we can maybe start to do differently as a community.
Just one more question to you, Dr. Walker. The racial trauma, as we're seeing it, is not going to go away. In fact, it's intensifying. How should we respond to that, understanding that it is one of the factors, an important factor here in leading to this increase among suicides in young African Americans?
I've been thinking about this for a while because I really am inclined to agree that it's not going anywhere. And that's why we have to be that much more invested in the community and reminding ourselves, reminding our young people what we have been through and what our strengths and talents are, and how there are so many other people trying to emulate who we are, that when we can reinforce and affirm in the community, you know, rather than internalizing racism, because that can happen a lot, you know, this idea that, well, maybe my life doesn't matter, or at least it doesn't matter in this classroom, you know, it doesn't matter to the police, that we make sure that we're not internalizing any of that, and that we instead hold tight to the idea of all the strength and all of the resilience and all of the creativity and all of the overcoming that has in fact happened in the community, and we reinvest in ourselves, and that can help to kind of mitigate the impact of the racial trauma. And then also turn off the TV, unfortunately. The imagery that replays when we see, you know, a young man or woman or someone dying, that does have vicarious effects that we need to minimize for each and every individual.
Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you so much for having us.
Diana Schlosser is a Boston-based child family therapist. Dr. Rita Walker is a professor at the University of Houston Department of Psychology and author of The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. And Joseph Feaster Jr., who lost his son to suicide and is both a council member at the Samaritans and executive committee member at the National Association of Mental Health here in Boston.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, May 29, 2021. So I have been told. our weekly compensatory call-in, dial in. If you have thoughts, questions, observations, today's date, oh, we just gave the date, Saturday, May 29, 2021. So I've been told, man, it has been a wacky week, month, year, all of the above. We'll be here on Tuesday, I believe. My calendar, I was trying to load it just as we began, got me a little discombobulated and it froze right as I was trying to load my calendar. But I think we'll be here on Tuesday. I guess it could theoretically be Wednesday, but I think I looked at the date correctly. It should be Tuesday. James H. Madison, white man, will be talking about his book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland. He has lots of pictures. He's specifically talking about Klan activity in Indiana, but it applies to a lot of things that were happening throughout the country at that time. But there's lots of, I guess, archival information in Indiana, including lots of photographs. Wow, stunning. Particularly because some of these, like, things that happened in like 1923 and things of that nature, and to see like 1,000 people or 1,500 white people, children, women, all out. Klan is coming for a rally or to hand out a pound of apples or something like that. Like, wow. System of white supremacy. White guests only. But that'll be Tuesday, I think. James H. Madison, recommended by one of our listeners, reading is more important than watching television. It will be interesting to contrast that with the whole Capitol nonsense and such as we proceed, but that is forthcoming. If you have commentary, questions you would like to share for this broadcast, the number to dial, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Okay, I will see if I can. There we go. Make sure I share this one before anything else wacky happens with my tabs. I just mentioned they are not going to have a serious commission inquiry into the white terrorist activities on January 6th. I think many of us predicted that they were not going to seriously prosecute, since there were many, many thousands of white people who were involved in those events. And it looks like they're maybe going to prosecute about 200-250 folks and then probably give them, you know, misdemeanors and then expunge it from their record, and they'll be all good. They can write books about it and do documentaries and joke about it with their grandchildren later. No big deal. Similar activities in California. Now, this was in the LA Times today. Huntington Beach copes with aftermath of viral TikTok party. Now, this is the same beach where they had hordes of white people because they had closed this beach previously because of the Rona. And white people were out at this beach. You're not going to tell us what to do and push us around. And the anti-vaxxers and white supremacists, all of that. Same beach. So I'm not going to read this whole report. I'm just going to try to tick down here, get to some of the significant chunks. Portion one. On Saturday night, roughly 2,500 teenagers and young adults, mostly white, some who say they drove for hours or flew from other states, converged on the Huntington Beach Pier and downtown area in a gathering that devolved into mayhem. Partygoers, I thought that was a very interesting noun. Partygoers. Not hooligans, lawbreakers, miscreants, partygoers, blasted fireworks into a mob. Haven't we been talking about reckless use of fireworks for like more than a year? It's almost July 4th again. Like, it's time to get rowdy again. But haven't we been talking about reckless use of fireworks? They started like fires at, in the middle of the, let me start from the beginning. Partygoers blasted fireworks into a mob in the middle of Pacific Coast Highway, jumped on police cars, scaled palm trees and flagpoles, and leapt from the pier into throngs of people below to crowd surf. A window at CVS was smashed. Freddie Gray. Businesses were tagged with graffiti, and the roof of Lifeguard Tower 13 collapsed after it was scaled. Skipping down a little bit, the last portion I'll read. Clashes with police broke out Saturday, and officers fired rubber bullets and pepper projectiles as they tried to disperse the crowd. Eventually, authorities issued an overnight curfew to clear the streets. Partygoers also descended onto Surf City on Friday and Sunday, but Saturday brought the largest group. So apparently they came for another come on. The majority of those taken into custody over the weekend were not from Orange County, police said. Now, I knew I was supposed to read this because the book club, we've been reading about Orange County for like 2 weeks now. I think we had a whole chapter titled Orange County, and they got the John Wayne Airport. They probably flew into the John Wayne Airport, a lot of these folks, to get to this party. Whew. Can you imagine? I wrote this out when I shared this online earlier. Can you imagine if O.J. Simpson, Gus T., Diddy, Dennis Rodman, we're out in L.A. We're scaling the pier, jumping on police cars, scaring white people. Can you imagine? They call us party goers. Like, come on. Come on. Negro terrorists. Like, come on. Come on. All right, we got a long list. Have to keep rolling. That's not even one that I played, but that was in the L.A. Times. You should check out that report as well, especially if you live in California. Like, oh, my. That's what you have in store for the summer, because that's what they said in the article. Like, it's going to be lots more. They said this is just the beginning. Next. Last week, caller in Florida, we're supposed to be about paying attention to words like partygoers. Last week, caller in Florida, he asked, hey, have y'all been paying attention? Have y'all heard them talking about hate crimes at some of these protests over what's happening between Israel and Palestine, so-called, and showing people who might be classified as white seeming like they're being attacked and all that, and they're calling these hate crimes. Have y'all seen that and heard this phrase being used? I said, no, I hadn't heard that. The report that we played was from Sunday, the very next day. Bings, like, wow, he's paying attention, be observant with the news, bravo. And they weren't saying hate crime, but they were saying hate attacks specifically. And I think they might have even referenced the same report about the attack in New York, someone classified as white, and they're fearful of going to all of these locations and whatnot. All right, something to be mindful of. Let's see, next. The report where they talked about the white people, individuals classified as white in the area of the world known as Germany, that they're looking at reparations for their terrorist genocidal conduct in Namibia. I knew about that because even before the context of white supremacy began, like, I could be super specific. Like, as soon as I saw that report, I was like, oh, I read about this in Military History Quarterly. Like, white people generally write books and brag about how they've, you know, mistreated Negroes all over the world. So I said, I read about it. I remember the exact report and the location at the University of Washington Library. That is a federal depository. So they have all kinds of documents on how white people have mistreated Negroes all over the world. So it's Military History Quarterly, June 1991. The name of the report is The Final Solution in Southwest Germany. It has a lot of grisly detail. Did you hear in that report how they killed women, children? You don't have women, but you know. And white people don't care about children. They said they killed women and children. And in this report, Military History Quarterly, they talk about how some of them, they didn't, you know, strangle them and rape them. Some of them, they drove them into the hills, had them surrounded and just made them stay there. Right. They got them. So if they came out, they would kill them, capture them, all that. And so they just starved them to death. Didn't have anything to eat, just, and lots of people died like that, being out in the desert, hinterland, not having any access to resources. But you heard in the report, they said they killed all of these black people and then gathered up their skulls and took them back to Europe to support all of their, talk about pseudoscientific bullshit and white superiority. Did you hear all of the Military History Quarterly, June 1991. The report is The Final Solution in Southwest Africa. Next, they talked about Tulsa again, I guess the so-called, where it's been 100 years since that terrorist activity took place. Talked a lot about that last week. They interviewed Olivia J. Hooker, Miss Olivia J. Hooker, one of the victims of that event. She talked about, in fact, the incident that she recalled, them having to hide, talk about childhood trauma, them having to hide, and they can hear white terrorists coming in with an axe and butchering her sister's piano. Nigger shouldn't have a piano. They hack it up. I said, man, I think like I've heard that before. I know that's in Rosewood, Don Cheadle, like the dramatization, a whole separate event of white terrorism, but like I literally feel like I've heard that before, like a black person talking about they had a piano and that really bothered racists that a nigra had a piano. Like, you know, are you serious? This nigra's got a piano? I don't have a piano. Not to mention I can't play it, but forget about that. What is this nigra doing with a piano? Let's go kill the whole family and the dog. But she said that they were resilient and that they moved to Topeka, and they said we just got to move on and move forward, whatever that means. And I said, man, move to Topeka. Yikes. That was that's one of the title cities for the Brown v. Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas. That's like the full official title of the court case. Like, man, you move. What do they say? The metaphor, you move out of the frying pan and into the fryer. Like, man, like no escape at all. Let's see. Next, they're talking about disinformation with Black Lives Matter. Lots of disinformation with regards to lots of things this year. But in that report, they said that this comes from the same anti-civil rights playbook. And I thought, wow, that is a really like tacky metaphor at minimum. And in my view, a deliberate, willful racism, white supremacy, even though that was a non-white person giving the report. In my view, white people practice racism in directly, indirectly. We're not allowed to speak honestly about racism victims, non-white people. We're not allowed to speak accurately, conditioned, trained to speak inaccurately about racism, white supremacy. It's not the anti-civil rights playbook. Now, I mean, just the term playbook alone. Are we talking about a football game? I know it's the NBA playoffs and all the rest of it. I mean, this is not a sporting contest that we're talking about. We are talking about war against non-white people, especially black people. That is not a playbook. If anything, if you want to put an official title on it, COINTELPRO, because that is exactly what they did. I just said we've been reading Geronimo Pratt. That's exactly what they did. They had whole titles of it where they would just go and lie and say, oh, yeah, this person is a communist and Dr. King, ooh, he's a Marxist, and just name calling. I said racist man, racist woman. They are the queens and kings of name calling. Oh, he's a communist and a subversive and a Marxist. And they just keep going and keep going with all kinds of names to call these people and undermine your credibility and have people think, oh, he's a black identity extremist. And, you know, she's, ooh, and all the rest of this nonsense. It ends up having real world effects. But the minimum, it's not, I shouldn't say it's not nonsense, because people died behind that. People lost their jobs and all kinds of things. So that's not a playbook. It's not nonsense. COINTELPRO, criminal activity, racist, white supremacist conduct, like lots of different more accurate ways of describing behavior as opposed to their playbook. I think they, in the book we're reading on Geronimo Pratt, they use the term dirty tricks. That's the same thing. What are we talking about? Illegal activity is what we're talking about in many cases. Continuing. They had the segment, talk about accuracy, wowzers. They had the segment featuring Tamara K. Knopper and Brenda Stevenson. Now, these are two non-white people. The entire time, the lead that I was going to use for that segment was going to just be an echo of white guests only. I went with this, the clip from Do the Right Thing, where they're having the riot and the Korean store owner says, "I'm black too," and blah, 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 and all that. They don't burn his store down. But that segment, like, wow, white guests only. And full disclosure, we have been on the air so long. Way back in 2010, I invited Tamara K. Knopper to be a guest on the program. She accepted. We had a date for the program. Like many other guests where this has happened before, she went and listened to the program, and specifically that we did with Henry Macko. Macko, like tobacco. Henry Macko, white man suspected racist. And he was the first time he was a guest on the program in the spring of 2010. About this time, 11 years ago. The first time he was on the program, we talked about the pattern of emasculation and encouraging anti-sexual homosexual behavior. That's what we talked about, and she was not pleased about that. She said, "I did not like his views, and you seem to agree with what he had to say." Now, we've had a number, particularly non-white guests, where they actually agreed to be guests on the program and then reneged because they didn't like a view that we had, or they didn't like a guest that we had on the program. All of that, I think, is absurd. PBS, NPR, whomever else, they can interview anybody that they want to about any subject matter. And it's whatever. Share their views. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Henry Macko comes on and we can't ask him questions or whatever. We're supposed to, I guess she felt like, in fact, she said, "You need to educate yourself about LGBTQ issues." I don't think they had the I and the A. That wasn't as prominent back in 2010. And she sent me a list of non-white individuals who I believe identify as gay or lesbian or queer or whatever else it is, to have them as guests on the program. And I told her, thank you. And that was the last that we spoke back in 2010. But white guests only. It took a long time to get there explicitly, but, and I guess full disclosure, we had a listener, even after I've been saying white guests only for almost a year, sent me Brenda Stevenson and said, "Hey, check out our book. Maybe she could be a guest on the program." Well, she wasn't invited. White guests only. Now I can look at this and say, oh yeah, she was not invited for a reason. White guests only. Now, I had to walk this slow because there's a transcript on this one, so I could walk this really slow. I thought what Tamara Knopper had to say about the anti-blackness that's come out, like some so-called Asians, I guess, are talking about these issues. Even those terms, so-called Asian, like, who are we talking about exactly? Are we talking about the vice president? Does she count? Like, who are we talking about exactly? Are we talking about President Obama? Who counts in this exactly? Anyway, once we get past all the terms, which can be rather confusing, I appreciate it, you know, acknowledging the anti-blackness and talking about different ways that that is manifest even in this present moment of so-called solidarity, whatever that means. I didn't even have to pause. The whole premise, I thought, for the whole segment, which is, again, white people to blame. That's not the victims. Tamara Knopper, she's a victim of white supremacy, so-called Asian. Brenda Stevenson, black female, victim of white supremacy. Victims, victims, victims. That said, white people, directly, indirectly, to even have a segment like that on black and Asian solidarity, what does that even mean? Like, are all Asian people in solidarity? I thought they have reports all the time about different people in Korea not getting on. They say North Korea and South Korea and these folks not getting along, and other folks who are also called Asian and different conflicts that they have. Do they have solidarity? Certainly we're not saying that black people have solidarity anywhere in the world. You can't even get black people on the continent. Ethiopia and Eritrea, do they have solidarity right now? Like, what are you even talking about? Anyway, all that notwithstanding, great acknowledging anti-blackness. That is a major problem. Moving forward, they get to Brenda Stevenson. So the question that gets asked, these anti-Asian attacks, I guess I'll pause there. Many people have said that they think they are making black people the so-called center, the target, the main culprits in these anti-Asian attacks. I've said consistently, that's not my view. It does seem like in the New York area, there are more incidents where it is a black perpetrator that's reported. But that's not my view, that they're trying to center this and make it seem as though black people are the main culprits. I think they said explicitly in that report that the main people perpetrating these crimes have been white. Anyway, so the question that was asked, I wonder, how do we talk about violence within communities of color and between communities of color without reinforcing extremely damaging stereotypes? What does that even mean? I mean, you wrote the book on Latasha Harlins, the 15-year-old killed in Los Angeles all those years back. How far have we really come? What a lame question. So, Brenda Stevenson, victim of white supremacy. This is the compensatory call-in where I request no metaphors. And what I say again, white guests only. Her answer to a really lame question. I think, again, it's a strange dance that we have with race in America. We come forward with many steps, twirl around, and we're going in the opposite direction. So this continues to happen. Victims guaranteed qualified, white guests only. There is a reason it's white guests only. There are many, many reasons why it's white guests only. There are also many, many reasons why it's no metaphors on the compensatory call-in. You all, hey, we can all articulate, choose whatever words we want about racism, white supremacy. But again, if we're talking about war being waged against individuals classified as not white, maybe the terms that we choose should reflect war being waged as opposed to a child's game or a dance or something that is playful, joyful, less than murderous warfare. Just a suggestion that I hope is logic-based. Again, victims guaranteed qualified. We got the transcript. She continued, so that the tail of her answer to this really lame question, she said, it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult. It is bound in the roots of American society. And once you eat of the tree of America, it becomes a part of you. No metaphors on the compensatory call-in. And then the interviewer, and the uprooting of all of that, I think, begins with conversations like this. Get out of here. Like, just remember last week when they said we got wildfires spread. In fact, the report on hate attacks was titled, "They're Springing Up Like Wildfires." They used that metaphor there, too. But remember a couple weeks back, they said we have lots of little wildfires blowing up everywhere. And this talking about racism was new kindling. And come on, come on, come on. Like, this is not the time to try to throw out as many cute, euphemistic, stupid metaphors as we can to not talk directly about the problem that is very common and encouraged for white supremacy racism. People do not want to be direct. Even, in fact, the interview, Stephanie Tsai, she did ask directly about white supremacy racism. She asked Tamara Knopper, that was her last question to her. She asked, what are your thoughts on the phrase white supremacy and how the system and that world that we all live in, a society where racial discrimination has shaped all of us, where Asian Americans fit in that equation? And she gave her answer about all that, how they relate to black people and what makes a race. She said what she said, all of that. Again, you do not be the only people who belong to a race are classified as white. The only reason to belong to a race is to practice racism. I guess I'd say that's another important aspect of why I think this segment just supports white supremacy, racism in general. You could have said, where's the Asian solidarity? Where's the black solidarity? Where's the Africans? I mean, whatever. Where's the white solidarity, for that matter? anything that reinforces thinking that you have racial classifications, like there's a black race and an Asian race and all of this, supports white supremacy racism. The only race, the white race. Next on the list. Should I get in my last? And we'll get to the folks who called in. The report on suicide, I thought it was so important. The first thing I thought of, retired firefighter, I think it was about a year ago, maybe a little bit more. He called in and he talked about a young black male in the South Florida area, I think might have been associated with the football team that he works with, and that he had committed suicide. And I thought it was stunning because he was so young. This is a young teenager. And then to have to talk about this repeatedly, where we've had other people talking about young black people who died at a very young age, and then suicide factoring into all of this. I've seen a few reports over the last year or so talking about increases in suicide amongst young black people. Very important subject matter, I thought. Mental health in general for everyone, but especially it has been a rough time for children for many, many reasons, for many of the same reasons as adults, and then for black children, especially the system of white supremacy racism. Reading is more important than watching television. One of the folks that they spoke to in that segment, Rita Walker, PhD, her book, The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health, Navigate an Unequal System, Learn Tools for Emotional Wellness, and Get the Help You Deserve, full title, just came out less than a year ago. Black female author. I was flipping through. I'll just read a little bit. This will give me an opportunity to snicker about Atlanta, too. Let me get a drink of water, because this was so funny, I thought. Unless I'm just wasting time for folks who want to comment. Be patient so I can get my Atlanta jokes in. I need two sips of water for Atlanta jokes. Let's see. All right. Woo, this is the foreword. Written by Naeem Akbar, full disclosure, who I also, in 2010, invited to be a guest on the program. He didn't even give us the okie doke and accept and then renege. He just said from the very beginning, like, you have got to be out of your mind. Get out of here. He didn't say it disrespectfully, but that was about the size of it. No disrespect either. He's a victim of white supremacy. Dr. Naeem Akbar, he wrote the foreword for The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm just going to read. This is second paragraph. He says, reading this book is like being a black person living in Minnesota or Rhode Island and suddenly awakening one spring morning and finding yourself on Peachtree Street in Atlanta with all the amenities of black life and culture. Man. Woo. Number one, I get to say it again. On this year, the compensatory call-in, there are many, many reasons I request no metaphors. That is a humdinger of a metaphor. And Gus T is speaking as a former Atlanta resident, not an Atlanta visitor, a former Atlanta resident who actually lived on Peachtree. Now, all of that entered into the record, I say, wow, Peachtree is a really long street that runs through the center of Atlanta. You could end up on Peachtree and be at Five Points. You could end up on Peachtree and be in Midtown. You could end up on Peachtree and end up in Buckhead. Those are all substantially different areas. Like, I mean, you're at Lenox Mall at one of those. You're at Magic City at one of, I mean, where on Peachtree are we magically landing to get all of this black culture and amenities? As someone who has lived in Seattle, now he said Minnesota or Rhode Island. I've lived in Seattle, Washington. This is a super white area as well. I think that might be. I'm guessing. I don't know for sure. But this would be comparable to Minnesota and Rhode Island as being a pretty white dominated area. If I plopped down on Peachtree anywhere, I would not be happy at all. It would be misery. And what can I do to get the hell out of here immediately? There is no place. And I have been back to Atlanta since I lived there. There is no place you could place me on Peachtree or in Atlanta, period, where I would think, oh, joy, I'm back in the Peachtree Strait. This is amazing. I didn't think that at all. My concluding thought was, wow, this is an area that has mastered the art of breaking black males. That was my concluding thought, and I was not studying white supremacy at the time. Hadn't even read Mr. Fuller's work. I've always been mystified at people who glorify the city of Atlanta. Like, back, I just said that yesterday. This is a city home to the CDC with all these Fortune 500 companies, and they don't even have like a ton of black people that are top executives at like Home Depot and Coca-Cola and all these other places. They don't even have that in Atlanta. Oh, they have tons of they even have a Federal Reserve there in Atlanta. Anyway, that's from the foreword. I saw that and just like, wow, that's he has lots of praise for the book. It might be spectacular. I've not read it all, but wow, in terms of a metaphor, I'm always curious about people that are glorify the city of Atlanta. Next portion of the book I will read, something let me get one constructive and then the thing that stood out to me. Suicide by neglecting physical health. They talked about getting back to exercise in the gym now that things are opened up. She writes, do you take insulin for type 2 diabetes? If so, do you take your insulin, eat right, exercise, and monitor your blood sugar as is required to manage your diabetes? The odds are, sadly, pretty high that you will say no to doing some of these. If you have a loved one who isn't taking care of their illness, you are a witness to the issues that escalate already poor health. I expanded my research beyond suicide to include diabetes because I have always been concerned about the connection between depression and physical health. People who have diabetes and other kinds of serious health problems often deal with depression. It is hard to manage a chronic illness like diabetes or high blood pressure when you are depressed. It makes sense that your mom could be feeling so low that she forgets to take her medication. But health neglect is not okay. When life is on the line, it is unacceptable to skip medication, mismanage serious health symptoms, and be a couch potato. It is self-destructive, but it is also part of the ongoing narrative. Here is some of the thinking that we have to change in our families and in our communities. She goes on to give a long list. High blood pressure runs in the family. The way my mama cooks isn't good for me, but that's the only way it tastes right, blah, 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 and all these other excuses and why you have to change them to take better care. Very important. All of this is in The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. Reading more important than watching television. What I thought was significant as well about this book was I checked and I said, oh, wow, all of this black mental health and blah, blah, blah. And I do know a psychiatrist who also spent a good bit of time talking about black mental health. Let's see if there's any mention of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing in this here book. No. Now, I'm certainly not saying that every, you know, black person, non-white person, victim of racism has to reference Dr. Welsing or anyone else when talking about racism. That is not the case. We all have our own brain computer. You can think for yourself, come up with new concepts, your own ideas, and how to articulate them. That is encouraged. I think Dr. Welsing would be the first person to encourage that. But it did strike me like, wow, to have a medical doctor who for decades talked about white supremacy, racism, and its specific impact on black mental health, and no reference at all. Like, wow, that, I don't know. That did not strike me as a ringing endorsement for this text. But again, the title, The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. Foreword by Naeem Akbar, not a guest on The Cows. I said it much times now. No metaphors for many. We are not doing a dance, the tango, the electric slide, the shuffle. We are trying to speak in an accurate way about the problem, white supremacy, racism. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your views, that would be grand. I will prompt if you need additional time, have additional thoughts. we should have time. Just make sure everyone gets to speak at least once, and then we can add you back to the line. If you could please use your mute button, that would be great, just to make sure we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise. Speaking of background noise, can I just get one more? So this here is Seattle, Washington, where I'm sitting outside. Didn't even get the crickets today. There is no way that would be possible anywhere that I know of on Peachtree in Atlanta. As someone who values quiet to be able to think or broadcast, participate in some form of counter-racism, I don't think being Atlanta on Peachtree at Magic City or Lenox Mall is conducive to counter-racist thought. I could be wrong. Shout to Lemon Pepper Lou. Go Hawks. Oh, that's right there in the play. Go Hawks, Trey. Matter of fact, freaking Dominique Wilkins was on Peachtree. Dominique flipping Wilkins. He should be the Prince of Atlanta. This could have been in the compensatory call-in. He said, I just retweeted it. I can read his tweet. I'll do it later in the program. He said he went to a restaurant on Peachtree in Atlanta and they kicked him out, blamed it on his dress code. Dominique flipping Wilkins. How is it that he can't be in footies and pajamas anywhere in Atlanta proper? And welcome, Dominique. Oh, my God. Sign my jersey. Dominique Wilkins is here. He's in his footies. Woo. I mean, that is the system of racism, white supremacy. Like, on Peachtree or in Atlanta. I mean, Seattle. That could happen here, too. I'm just saying, like, no. For many, many reasons, I would not be ecstatic about winding up on Atlanta on Peachtree specifically. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in, no disrespect to people that if you have the misfortune to reside in Atlanta, I'm sorry for you. No disrespect. Let's see. Wow, I'm struggling to get the switchboard here. I get excited when I get to get my giggles at Atlanta's expense. Let's see. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Oh, let's see, folks, I guess are spectating, or I didn't see hands. Folks are spectating, getting their thoughts together.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Just really quick, I wanted to mention how I think that term was used, people of color, I believe, with the solidarity and everything. I notice how when black people are mentioned and we're trying to counter the issue of white supremacy, and there is a tendency where the term people of color is used, and let's make sure we're including all of these quote-unquote other minorities. That's another term as well. And there was a term that another guy used in the segment where they were talking about how the Jewish individuals were being attacked or mistreated or something like that. And the guy from the word anti-defamation league. And he was like, you know, another group that I can compare this to is the anti-Asian hate crimes that have been going on. I think that's what he said. And to compare to what he was saying about the anti-Semitic crimes that's been going on. And at the end of it, he used the term about talking about the president, saying that he needs to be forcefully, he said force, and, you know, unambiguous, I think. Yeah. So he was like, unambiguous, like, basically, you need to basically talk about this. Don't pretty much group it with anything else or have it aligned with anything else. Talk about this issue. Unambiguous. So that, and there was one other thing that I had read a report on. They found a species, I guess, of a frog in Australia, and they used the term chocolate frog because it is brown. So, you know, I just looked at it like, wow, like whatever white people decide, that's what, you know, the term they decided to go with, they call it, or they're going to call it the chocolate frog. So that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Delectable Negro, delectable frog. Like, all right. Wow. They, see, and I am someone, I also appreciate unambiguous language. That way, nobody is confused. Like, that's been a big problem all throughout the pandemic. They've been talking about confusing messages and people, you know, trying to get understanding about what's being said. Like, hey, nobody, or at least I do not, and I think most people who, you know, like to get an understanding do not like ambiguity. He didn't want that. He like, hey, come out and speak forcefully against these, you know, anti-Semitic, I think that word was used, attacks. I'm of the opinion we should come out and speak accurately, forcefully against the system of white supremacy racism. But that doesn't happen very often. But yes, he was explicit about what he wanted. And yeah, very being observant, hate crimes, or I guess hate attacks, either manifestation. Yes, he is being used quite a bit for these incidents. Let's see. Much obliged caller in Florida. Other folks who dialed in *61, if you have comments here to share, should be with us.
Can I be heard clearly?
Not a family, but yes, sir, we can hear you.
All right. Good evening, Gus. Good evening, callers. Good evening, listeners. I wanted to talk about the suicide segment that you just played. Interesting observation that I think it was the Dr. Schlosser kept referring to the young black people who were committing suicide as kiddos. And there was another part of it where I think the author that you just referenced was saying that there was no definition for racism. Like, those two things I just found fascinating. And I'll move along. Thank you.
I don't use it, much obliged, sir. I don't use the term kiddos myself, right? But I did note that. It might have just been a euphemistic way of talking about a subject that is kind of sad. It's a term I don't use. I generally, boys and girls, children, those are the terms I would generally young people, I guess. Youth, I guess that's another one. I generally don't say kiddos, babies. I generally don't say kiddos. That's what I said when she was talking about definition, because she spent all that time saying that she spent two chapters in her book, which I've not read it completely. So I don't know what those chapters entail, but I know she does not mention someone who is a third generation physician, general and child psychiatrist, who talked about racism and black mental health for decades and emphasized the importance of having a definition for racism when we discuss this subject matter, so that we're not just throwing the word racism and or white supremacy around. It's actually attached to a logical, accurate definition. That was something that she emphasized. That's why I said it was so glaring to me that Dr. Welsing, it seems, is not mentioned in the text. I might be right. Haven't been able to read the whole thing, but yeah, that kind of stood out to me. I'll check it out. And again, reading more important than watching television. So, you know, folks can check out. I'm sure I read the section on health and diet, which I thought was really important. So I'm sure there are other helpful, constructive portions in the text. You know, check it out if you think it would be worth your time and energy. Let's see. Other folks with commentary that they wanted to share. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The Dominique Wilkins I got, he tweeted, so this is May 22nd. This is not ancient history. Today is May 29. Really, this could have been on the compensatory call because this got a lot of attention this week or the past 7 days or so. He wrote, "In many years in the world, I've eaten at some of the greatest restaurants in the world, but never have I felt prejudice or been turned away because of my skin until today in Atlanta." And then he mentions the restaurant, which I'm not going to name. And then he says, hashtag turned away because I'm black. Now, this is Hall of Fame Dominique Wilkins, who played almost his entire career for the Atlanta Hawks and is a current employee of the Atlanta Hawks, claiming he was turned away from a restaurant that I did look, even though I'm not going to name it. This restaurant is located on Peachtree in the illustrious Buckhead portion of Atlanta. It's further north, where incidentally they talk about seceding from the rest of the city, where it's more Negros and all the rest of it. Anyway, but yeah, that just happened ATL. Let's see. Again, we have, I guess, 30 minutes, unless we just have lots of folks who are spectating for the weekend and preparing for the holiday. Make sure I get in my public service announcement. It is so-called Memorial Day weekend, at least in the States. So if you are out and about, I know folks are maybe cutting loose. They loosened a lot of restrictions and such. So folks may be saying, hey, it's warmer weather. We are hitting the beach or doing, you know, the cookout of all cookouts and all the rest of it. Fine. Do whatever you do. I would still be pretty safe. It's still pretty. You heard what I read about Huntington Beach. I would still be pretty safe. I would still definitely be alert to, they will probably have sobriety checkpoints. If they're saying, oh yeah, people are getting out and things are back to normal, it's a holiday weekend, I'd be mindful of that as well. Alcohol as well. I think we just heard our caller in Florida yesterday talked about, it was a black male. He said he was at a party of some sort. Enforcement officials arrived. They got upset that there was an after party and they took it out on this black male. So I would be mindful about being any functions, lots of people, anything like that. I would try to be subdued for lots of reasons, but I would try and be subdued. If you are going to be at a function or what have you, I would have a code so that you can do that as safe as possible. Not attract too much attention, really, from anybody, neighbors, anybody else. Sobriety would be best. If you are going to consume any alcohol, then have a code for that. I would try not to be out and about on the road. If you're going to do whatever, maybe you can stay there and then leave the next day. Like I said, just have a code if you are going to have some sort of shindig to celebrate things returning to normal, so-called. Incidentally, the report about the officers in Missouri, the text messages, and the officer who they're saying apparently maybe he married this female so that he could shield her from having to testify about these racist text messages. And they didn't even want to go into details about what these text messages are. I would have loved for them just read the text messages. Like, I'm not going to break down and cry. We're not going to drive to Missouri to go beat this guy up or toilet paper his house. What is, redactions? We talked about that last week. Like, let's not redact everything. Let's have a clear expose. What was said? What were these text messages? Were they something that an officer? I don't want to just hear that they're racist, because I mean, that's What did he say? You know, did he say he didn't want to vote for President Obama? You know, he said he didn't like the movie Get Out. I mean, what did he say? Let's get the details on it exactly about what and what they said. And even the white woman, because I think that's important. This guy is texting you these things and your response isn't, oh, my God, I'm appalled. Get away from me. You all get married? Like, what? Like, come on. Come on. Racist, say it all the time. It's not patriarchy. Racist woman. Racist man. What I say, I don't say racist kiddos. I say racist child. Racist kiddos? She said what she said. Racist child. But yeah, I mean, if I am not a racist, I think the non-racist response is yikes. And this guy's an enforcement officer? Double yikes. Let me go snitch right now. It didn't seem like she did that. Maybe I'm wrong. Hopefully all this will come out in the trial and what have you. But yeah, I thought that was stunning too. And that's right in Missouri. Michael Brown Jr. 7 years. Hard to believe that much time has passed. 7 years. He'd be 25, I guess. 25. Context of white supremacy. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If maybe I misinterpreted, or if any folks, if you understood the response about the dance that we do metaphor, if that made any sense to you, you can feel free to let me know. Maybe I just didn't get it correctly. I don't know what twirling around and all that. I generally don't use the word twirl when I talk about the system of racism, white supremacy, but maybe that's where I've been messing up all these years. Let's see. I believe it's Tuesday. My tab, I was trying to get my email to do right so I could check my calendar, and it froze up right as we were getting ready to go live. So I'll double check the calendar, but I'm pretty sure it's June 1, which would be Tuesday. It's James Madison, his book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland. And as I said, he does speak explicitly about the role of white women. He has, lots of pictures. I was kind of surprised because a lot of times these kind of staunchy, dusty history books, they don't have like a ton of pictures. They'll just be footnotes and information type of a thing. Like I said, that with Gerald Horn books, Dr. Gerald Horn's book, The Bitter Sweet Science, he didn't really have pictures of Jack Johnson and Sugar Ray Robinson, lots of these different folks, Truman Gibson. He didn't really have pictures of these folks. This book has lots of pictures, and so you see lots of racist women at these rallies and marches and dressed up and whole families and all the rest of it. It's stunning. And the one that I'm looking at right now, August 1, 1922, to have all of this memorabilia saved for a century. That's what I've said for years. White people can't be ignorant about white supremacy racism, because that would mean that they are ignorant about their aunts, uncles, grandparents, fathers, all the rest of it. And that is not the case. I mean, they got addicts. They got grandparents where they went and visited these folks once or 50 times in life, or they have the grandparents and aunts and uncles and all the rest have come and visited them. They are not ignorant about what they've done. Grandpa, tell me about your life. There is no one classified as white in the known universe who can truthfully say, hey, my life as a person classified as white, one of the central things, the system of racism, white supremacy, would have to be any area of people activity, any era. You heard what they were talking about in Germany. Any era, that's what we'll be chatting about. Less I'm in error. We'll ask James H. Madison, because these pictures are stunning. They just keep going on and on and on. It's just pages of them. And it's like every page is not, dude, that's not it at all. That's another point he emphasizes, that it was all sections. This was not just down and out toothless, broke white people, that is a total lie. You had all cross sections of white people who were in the Klan. That's not even just saying white people who practiced racism. That's just saying like white people who were active, like dues paying members of the KKK at the time. And it was huge numbers. He was even saying that Indiana was overrepresented in some sense, that he said, I think at like the heyday, like every other white person was like a member of the Klan, like an official dues paying member of the Klan in the state of Indiana at one point. Like, can you imagine? Oof. Anywho, if we have any Atlanta listeners, feel free if you want to call in and give a boost for Atlanta and stick up for the city. Feel free. I will say both James Brown and the great Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, both born in the state of Georgia, both of them have said on the record, Georgia was not the best place to grow up as a black person, particularly black male, both of them. And they have, I guess, maybe slightly different views, perspectives, political views, maybe. But they both came to the same conclusion about Georgia. Like, wow, this was not the easiest place to grow up as a black person. I would agree. It did not sound like they would have been overjoyed to wake up and be back in Atlanta on Peachtree. Maybe they would have. I don't know. We'll have to ask. Maybe someone can ask Supreme Court Justice Thomas, if he woke up and was back on Peachtree, how he would feel about all of that. Incidentally, the report where they were talking about suicide, which, again, I thought so important, black mental health, so important, racism, white supremacy at the core of our mental health problems. All of that notwithstanding, I don't think that our being rooted or connected to some sort of African-Americanness, whatever that means, I don't think that that will improve black mental health. Particularly, it struck me as odd because I've heard it. It's almost a cliche. People have said for years, white people and non-white people, that there's a stigma in the black community about mental health, and black people don't seek out mental health, and they don't go to mental health professionals, and black people don't think that they suffer from mental health problems. That's what I've heard for like years, decades. People have said that. So I don't understand how this sort of community, which seems to minimize these type of issues, how would they be a buffer and a support for mental health problems? And even, I don't even know what it means, saying African-Americanness, whatever that means, how would that insulate you or help in dealing with mental health as caused by white supremacy racism? Maybe that's answered in the book. Maybe I need to read it. If someone reads it, maybe they can do a counter-racist book review. I'll post it on my blog. I'll read it on the program. We'll share if you get the book. I'll give the title out again. It's The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. But yeah, maybe those questions are answered, but I'm not really sure how being rooted in or connected. I'm not really sure what that means. Again, African-Americanness or blackness. But yeah, I don't know how that would, even if it's just other black people, because they're victims too, and they're having the same type of mental health problems to varying degrees. So I don't know how helpful they would be. I think Dr. Welsing emphasized the importance of acknowledging reality, the truth of white supremacy racism, which I think she says she did in the book as well. I think she spoke a lot about that, not being rooted in blackness per se, but just being rooted in being truthful about what we are dealing with and doing things that are self-affirming, studying this system, trying to learn, be constructive with your time and energy. Those are the type of suggestions that I remember her giving out quite a bit. Taking care of your body, exercising, eating correctly too. She certainly spoke a lot about that too, but yeah, I would maybe need that explained. If other folks, any thoughts, we'll give 5 minutes or so. If folks are spectating, then we can wrap up a little bit early. If folks have any other thoughts, questions to share.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I was also thinking about the segment where I think that might have been where who are talking about the mental health problems. And they were talking about how when you're trying to point out racism and how Black people are conditioned through multiple generations to just accept it and just endure it and I guess be complacent. I'll use that word, I guess. And I just thought about how she mentioned that it's in the workplace, it's everywhere, and how you also have to deal with when you are addressing the problem with white people and they already have it set up to where, hey, I don't know if this qualifies as racism or that, you know, a white person walking through saying a certain thing. And it's like that, I do notice that as well, like where it's like, well, they have to say some kind of a slur. They have to use the word watermelon or something like that and codify a Black person's name to something. And because racism is refined, like the people I work with definitely are refined. But, I do notice that where they set it to where you have to conform or converge to, you know, what they think is racist. And it has to be something like a slur usually, or using direct words to it like KKK, and then see the expressions and the metaphors are used too. So yeah, you know, that is an interesting point as well, like, because that also adds on to the stress to where Black people are already confused about racism. So I think I was talking about the suicidal ideation, I think. Was that on that segment, Gus? I'm trying to remember if I'm talking about the same one.
With the stress component, yes. I believe that was talking about the suicide. Yes, Black people being stressed and trying to talk about racism. Yeah, I think that was on the suicide portion.
Okay. Because when she was pointing out how and I definitely think that's a part of racist code when they respond. You're being too sensitive. Are you sure this is racist? I don't know. Like I've noticed that. Like I've gone through that, and I've seen white people respond that way. And that's pretty much all I wanted to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I am of the opinion that being able to talk about things accurately, particularly racism, that helps reduce stress. I'm of the opinion confusion is stressful. When you can time, particularly things that have confused you for a long time and caused you a lot of problems, caused you daily problems like white supremacy, racism, when that's happening, and you can't, I mean, anybody, I think anybody knows the, like, just minor irritation of when you're searching for a word, right? This is a metaphor, so be warned. Anyone knows the minor irritation of when you've, like, forgotten a word that you're trying to say. It's either somebody's name or a specific term that you want to use, and you forget it momentarily, and how frustrating that can be to not, you know, be able to articulate yourself clearly in the way that you want. That is a lot of non-white people with white supremacy, racism, Gus T. Renegade included, where frequently we're not able to, like, accurately, efficiently articulate what's happening. And so you end up with a lot of these metaphors and just odd ways of responding to these questions and things. And in my opinion, that in and of itself causes stress and is confusing, like when you're not even able to get the words out. At least that would help, like you can explain it to some other people, and so maybe you can help them get a better grasp of what's happening, explain it to other non-white people. Even articulating it to yourself accurately sometimes can be helpful. So yeah, and that is so I think that's important too. That is encouraged, both components. When they blame non-white people about the mental health component, frequently it's white people who have punished Black people for centuries for talking about racism, trying to bring this up as an issue, trying to solve this problem. White people have conditioned us all over the world to ignore racism, to not talk about racism. We've had tons of non-white people over the years who've talked about they've tried to get mental health, to go to talk to a mental health professional not named Dr. Welsing, and they've been hey, we're not talking about racism in here. Hey, I'm not going to be able to help you if you keep bringing up this racism stuff. Trying to do something constructive, I'm trying to help you. And you just thought the white man did this and white people did that. Let's have some personal, what is a personal responsibility. We've had people who talked about that. When we've had people who said, hey, I'm even done with the whole can. It's not because they don't believe black people have mental health problems. It's not because they don't believe in counseling. It's because they've experienced racism from the counselors. And they said, well, I'll see if I can find a black person where I can talk about racism. And either that's been a problem, which is another component of the racism, or even a lot of the non-white therapists. We're not just going to keep talking about racism. Not all, but I mean, it's not tons of Dr. Welsings out there. Anyway, striving for accuracy. The interview with Tamara Knopper, Brenda Stevenson, that was with Stephanie Tsai. As I said, Stephanie Tsai appears to me to be a non-white female. It seems she would be classified as so-called Asian female. That doesn't alter the main thrust of what I said. White people directly, indirectly are responsible for segments like that. They can easily insert a non-white person and be the one who is facilitating the interview. I am certain Stephanie Tsai is not the most powerful person in charge at PBS or even that specific segment at PBS. I could be in error. They have editors, I believe, at PBS. Let's see. Any other folks, comments, questions, observations they want to make sure they get in last minute before we get ready to wrap things up? Folks spectating for holiday weekend, I reckon. Again, I guess I'll have to update if it's not June 1. I guess it could be June 2, but my recollection is that it was June 1. Hopefully I'll be able to look at my calendar without it freezing up and we'll determine. But I think it's June 1, which would be Tuesday, that we'll have James Madison here. We'll talk about his book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland, and specifically contrast that and certainly get in the role of white women, even though he's a white man. But we'll contrast that to what happened January 6th. No inquiry into these terrorist activities seems very on par with white culture in general. And like I said, there's so many pictures of white children. I cannot emphasize that enough. Reading is more important than watching television. This is one, I guess, if it's available online or if you go to a library sometime in the future as they're beginning to reopen, if you stroll by the section where this book is shelved, just maybe look at the pictures for a second because there's so many of them. But look at how many children. If you have offspring, you should show them. Like when they talk about white people being ignorant about racism, like, hey, they have the children at the Klan rally. How would they be ignorant? How would you be at this event and then say that you are ignorant about racism? You don't ask any, why are they burning the cross? That you don't ask these questions. That's generally what children do. What is going on? Where are we at? Who are these people? Why are they wearing these? You ask questions like, I'm trying to understand, like, what is going on? What is the Negro? What do they keep saying? The Negroes are running amok. What's going on? What are we doing about the Negro? Maybe the children go and don't ask any questions, but I don't know too many children who don't ask questions. I don't have children myself, but I have been around them and they are inquisitive, woo, especially at a young age. Maybe these are, you know, we're just bored. We're just hanging out. Maybe waiting to get back home to get on that PS5. We don't care about this rally. Yeah. But I think that's Tuesday. I might be wrong. I think it's Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I'll update if, you know, my memory is in error. And then we'll wrap up Geronimo Pratt, Last Man Standing on Thursday. Wow, it has been informative. I've learned so much about other random court cases that I was not aware of. As I said, took us right back to Orange County, that was mentioned in the report today, Huntington Beach, report of white debauchery and shenanigans. Party goers, words are important once again. But we'll finish that up on Thursday as well. Much obliged for folks tuning in, even though we had a good healthy chunk of spectators for the evening. I'll assume folks are all good with their commentary and or observations. We'll do it again on, I believe, Tuesday. Looking forward. You can have your questions ready for a white man. We are listener supported. Counter Racist Radio Invest. If you think the cows is constructive, hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Cash App is also linked there. The Cash App address, cash.app/$thecows. Huge thanks to all the investors who have kept us broadcasting for a dozen plus years. Hopefully constructive information we have shared. Also, you can support at our Amazon wish list. It's linked under Gus T. Renegade, or listed under Gus T. Renegade. Much gratitude to all of the folks who have nabbed an item or three for Gus T. over the years. Hopefully, the program continues to be worthy of your time and energy. That's it. Hopefully, you all can stay safe. I know it's supposed to be a so-called holiday weekend. To me, all that means is probably a lot more alcohol and narcotics use, because people will say, oh, we have, you know, an extra day of debauchery. Let's go to Huntington Beach and cut a fool, jump on police cars and all the rest. So I would be mindful. You can use your time and energy constructively. You can get more sleep. Emmy bragged about that yesterday. Said, I got time away from work. That means more rest. Talk about mental health. Like, very few of us actually get adequate sleep because we're in a system of white supremacy. So if you got extra time, get some extra snooze in. And then, you know, stay sober. Have your code to stay as safe as you can over the next few days as they, you know, celebrate and all the rest. Fireworks. Whew. All the rest of the madness. Just stay safe. Sobriety would be best. I say that every weekend. It goes double for this weekend. They will probably have sobriety checkpoints. So if you are going to be out driving, definitely no alcohol, no nothing. Hands are at 10 and 2. Expecting to see enforcement officials. In addition to being sober, if you are going out, I would be very mindful about what's happening around you. People could be acting very loony, like, man, we haven't been outside in so long, and let's cut loose and act a fool, depending on where you are. Just be mindful. I still say it's not a good time to be confronting strangers. If they're being hostile and loud, you should still be thinking this person might be armed. They might have a whole group with them that's armed and ready to be violent. You didn't leave your residence prepared to die and or kill. Exit. Live to enjoy the summer. All of that's it. And if you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. Again, just doing the small things that we can to try to stay as safe as we can through what probably will be another very rowdy summer in the system of racism. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling. That is an easy one. I don't know about black Asian solidarity or any other sort of solidarity. I don't even see racists having too much solidarity myself. But one thing that we can do to minimize conflict, not name calling. That right there would be spectacular. Just making an effort to minimize conflict as best we can with other non-white people, and then we can also all work on being unambiguous with our use of words. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.